Hey, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Interrupting cow.
Moo! Hello and welcome to JudgeCast. This is episode 318. I'm one of your hosts, Brian Prilliman, and I am joined this evening, afternoon, morning drive to work by the one and only Charles Feather.
Howdy, partner.
Oh, jeez. And the one and only Marco Sanchez.
Yeehaw.
I did it once, but I'm done. I'm over.
Yeah.
I'm over.
That's it. Yeah, done.
That's it. That's all you get. That's it. I promise. Maybe.
And this episode is going to be our set review of Oops All Hats. or is it Oops All Played Out Western Tropes? No, it is the Outlaw of Thunder Junction release notes, which I keep writing as OJT for on the job training instead of
OTJ.
I write it as OJT though.
Right.
Anyway, you might have enjoyed hat stickers in Unfinity and cards that cared about hats. You might have cared about piebald hats and fedoras in Murders of Karlov Manor. Well, now put spurs on your centaurs and your cowboy hats on your head. Yep, let's pitter-patter, let's get at her.
Yep.
All right.
You know all about our Infinity, don't you, Brian?
Yeah, I love stickers.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, all right. Who wants to explain this eye chart of card legality? Like, what all is in Outlaws?
That eye chart's just where we can find certain cards. It's not even card legality. There's just a whole list of things that are happening here, though.
So what is this list? We're looking at a list.
So
our listeners aren't. What do we got?
Yeah, so the first thing we're going to do is we'll talk about play boosters. They're a thing. there are about, right now, three or four different things put into a booster pack. You have the main set, which will have the set code of OTJ, very nice cowboy hat icon as the set symbol. You have the big scorer, which is set code BIG, which is the Millennium Falcon USS Enterprise, although I argue that it's not the USS Enterprise because the nacelles aren't long enough, but I'm going to go deep on that.
You know, that's very astute.
Fault door it icon is. Thing. I just don't think it looks like the Enterprise. I think it looks like one of the science vessels or something. Anyway.
Indeed.
It has the OTJ commander cards, which has the set code OTC, cowboy hat with a shield behind it, and those are new cards. It has breaking news. Jeez. How many different things are in play boosters these days?
Just keep going.
Set code OTP, which is jail cell bars icon for all reprints. And then it has, of course, special guests because it has the set code SPG, the star icon surrounded by a pentagon, all reprints but new art to flavor the plane. What's important to know is what's not in play boosters. What's not in play boosters are textured foil borderless breaking news cards. That's one type of card. It's not like five different cards. open vault cards, raised foil open vault cards, and extended art cards. And to get those cards, you have to go to collector boosters.
So I'm gonna claim ignorance here. What is an open vault card?
I have no idea.
I don't off the top of my head either.
Okay. Hold on. Through the magic, do a little clicky thing. Let's
pause. I assume it's like the limited with the like a limited edition, limited number of one of 500 serialized, I guess. I don't know. That's my guess.
But then it's raised foiled open vault cards.
Now here's what's interesting. Nowhere in here do I see the word list card. I wonder if open vault is list or some equivalent, but I don't know. Are we finding out?
Who's looking?
Oh, so the 30 mythic rares from the big score also have a special booster fund treatment, the vault frame treatment, which... Oh, it's like these are all the things that are in the vault that they're trying to break into, and it's like a special check out these classic artifacts that are fixed. Sword of Wealth and Power, Black Lotus on a Ring.
Okay, yeah, there's something in the story about opening a vault. Gotcha. So what we're talking about here is what's that other set where we talk about vaults?
The Hell Vault?
No, well, there's that one, but there's the recent one, the gimmicky one,
the Ocean's 11 Universes Beyond set.
Yeah, it's anyway. Universes Beyond set.
Oh, Vault Boy, the Fallout
with whatever
Fallout.
Thank you. Yeah, it's cool.
Great, wonderful. Yeah. Okay, so we figured out what open vault cards are, and the answer is we don't care.
More card treatments.
Yay!
Okay, people like that.
Cool. And let's not call them big scorecards or big vault score. Whatever. Who cares?
Big vault scorecards.
Yeah.
I mean, big. You have to keep track of who's winning.
And then we've got because I guess raised foil big score open vault cards.
That was good. Sorry, I was putting markers on our timeline to know when we need to come back in.
Yeah. Okay. I've just stopped caring.
Okay. So we look it up. Back in. Go ahead.
Got it.
Oh, so, I was actually saying, like my scorn and derision was actually, you know, I was fine with that being in the podcast.
Something he wanted to share?
Yeah, no, sure. Okay.
Oh, no, it will be.
So we spent, just to summarize, all you people, we spent maybe like 2 minutes on Google each trying to figure out what open vault cards and raised foil open vault cards were, and then when we discovered what they were, it wasn't worth the 2 minutes we spent looking it up. It's basically just alternate art treatments for the big scorecards.
Pretty.
Crack that ball.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we also have some mechanics that are pretty cool that we should be talking about.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Let's talk
new
about
new mechanics
hats.
Are always great.
Let's talk about hats, baby. Let's talk about. Okay. No, what do you want? Go.
I just wanted to see how long that would play out.
We have so many cards.
We have so many cards.
I'm gonna be good.
Let's get right into it. Let's talk about Outlaw. So, Outlaw is a new game turn that refers to any card that has a particular creature type. So, Magic over the past few years has been doing what they call like batches of something, like Historic, where it was artifacts and legendaries and sagas, or Party, where it was four different types of creatures that was your adventuring party. So here we have Outlaws. Outlaws refers to any card with the assassin, mercenary, pirate, rogue, or warlock creature type. And it just makes things easier to reference instead of having to write all of that out every time, even though they probably will. You can just say whenever another outlaw enters the battlefield. So for example, let's read Vile Smasher, who's wearing a cowboy hat. Gleeful Grenadier for black and a red. It's a 3/2 legendary creature, goblin mercenary, so it is an outlaw. Whenever another outlaw enters the battlefield under your control, Vile Smasher, Gleeful Grenadier deals 1 damage to target opponent. And then in handy reminder text, it reminds you, assassins, mercenaries, pirates, rogues, and warlocks are outlaws. Now, important here, outlaw is not a creature type, so if you have to name a creature type, you can't say outlaw and expect it to just cover the set of cards that are outlaws. You have to choose a specific listed creature type. If something refers to you controlling an outlaw, it refers only to the permanents that you control with one or more of those types. And otherwise, an outlaw spell can mean a spell on the stack that has one of those types. An outlaw card is a card that has the subtype that is associated with outlaws. It's these types of cards. Savvy? Wait, that's pirates. That's outlaw. That's flavorful. They do crimes. Everything's fine.
All right. Yep. See, they've gone so over the top with flavor and stuff. Like, even, like, trying to make puns about the next card just isn't... The next card name just isn't... They took all the fun in making the cards and left no fun for the rest of the people. Anyway.
Yeah.
We're going to talk now about crime. Okay, so crime is a mechanic that basically, what's the word for it? It's kind of a player commits a crime. So all these cards, like I'll give an example. Raven of Fell Omen says whenever you commit a crime, okay? So this is like whenever the ring tempts you is a thing. So commit a crime means, that you have, you commit a crime as you cast a spell, activate an ability, or put a triggered ability on the stack that targets at least one opponent, at least one permanent spell or an ability an opponent controls, or at least one card in an opponent's graveyard. All right. So this is sort of like, you know how we say, like, protection from white means a whole bunch of things and we have this little acronym to remember? Crime is also, committing a crime is also targeting, like, your opponent or any of your opponent's stuff. But any of your opponent's stuff is limited to the opponent, a permanent they have, a spell, or an ability they control. So making an opponent discard one of their cards, which I guess you'd have to target the player in order to get them to discard a card. So I guess maybe that counts. But yeah, there, it's okay, fine.
I mean, if it affects as each opponent discards a card, that's not a crime.
Yeah, it's got a target. That's the important word. Target is the thing that you got to pay attention to. So if you mess with your opponent's stuff, in general, you're committing a crime. Okay? Exile a card in their yard, crime. Target one of their lands, crime. All right. If I do something that targets, but here's the thing, like, Wrath of God, not a crime.
Okay? It should be.
Farewell, not a crime. Although that also that should be. So, The spell or ability that constituted the crime doesn't have to resolve yet, or at all. As soon as you target it, okay, you committed a crime. Okay, once
so
the ability's
on... you don't have to get away with it.
Right, you can get caught. Okay, you still committed the crime, and you still need to do the time. A player can only commit a single crime per spell or ability that they control. So if you target three opponents, you're only committing, you just committed a single crime. Okay. Easy enough. Now, Here's the thing. The initial targeting is all that's necessary for committing a crime. Okay. And what I mean by that is changing the target of a spell or ability. Like if you somehow shift to the target, like you play one of those spells that lets you redirect and, you know, something else becomes the target of a spell or ability. You know, so if I'm targeting Marcos with a spell and then something happens that causes it to redirect and target Charles.
Deflecting SWAT.
Deflecting SWAT. That's not committing a crime again. This is a player commits a crime as they cast the spell. Okay, so once it's already on the stack, once it's set, redirection effects, anything like that, doesn't change anything. If you're thinking like, oh, well, what about, I can't believe I'm blanking on the name, the Phyrexian artifact that lets you redirect everything to everything.
Spellskite.
Spellskite, thank you. Like, I was imagining the art, and I was like, just scroll up a little bit and read the card name, what's it say? But yeah. No Spellskite shenanigans. Anyway, that's all I got to say about committing a crime. Don't commit a crime.
Yeah.
I guess unless you're a billionaire and then you know, there's no consequences.
Brian bringing the real talk this week.
Yeah, I'm kind of down. This set, they had so much fun making this set, they didn't leave enough for the rest of us.
The plot thickens.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Brian's a sad panda.
I am a sad panda. All right. What do we got next?
We have plot. And we're going to venture into a creature, the Black Snag Buzzard. For two and a black, it is a 2/1 creature bird that has flying. It has a nice little ability. Black Snag Buzzard enters the battlefield with a +1/+1 counter on it. If a creature died this turn, and then it has the interesting ability plot for one and a black. So you may pay one and a black and exile this card from your hand. Cast it as a sorcery on a later turn without paying its mana cost. Plot only as a sorcery. So let's talk a little bit about this. You can only play a card's plot cost, exile the card face up, and then cast it later in turn with... you can pay a card's plot cost, exile the card face up, and then cast it later in the turn without paying its mana cost. Plot abilities are written plot cost, which means anytime you have priority during your main phase while the stack's empty, you may pay cost and exile this card from your hand. It becomes plotted at that point in time. So that's how you enter into, in this case, a plotted card. I think we're going to find one or two other things that will do this indirectly now, later on.
Right? Now I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Now, plotting, in the reminder text, it says plot only as a sorcery.
Yes.
Okay. So does that mean if I have something that lets me cast sorceries at instant speed, anytime I could cast an instant, would I be able to plot at instant speed?
No, because it's not a sorcery. It's only talking about the speed at which it happens. Right?
But I changed a thing that lets me... That changes the speed of when sorceries happen.
No, you change the speed at which other spells happen. Plot's still an ability that's right. Locked around sorcery speed okay. Actions.
Yeah, yeah. So play as a sorcery means during your main phase when the stack is empty. So it's not any time you could play a sorcery. It's a phrase that deconstructs into something more complete.
Okay. So plot is... Great. We have another special action, everybody. Plot's a special action. Once you announce you're taking that action, no other player can respond. It just happens. You still have to pay for it, of course. Similar to turning a face-down creature up with its morph or disguise cost, plot is something that cannot be directly interacted with at the time that it's declared. You can't cast a plotted card on the same turn it became plotted. Any future turn, you may cast that card without paying its mana cost during your main phase, while the stack is empty, regardless of the card type and regardless of flash, as far as we know at this time. Casting a plotted card from exile is using an alternate cost to cast the spell, so you can't choose any other alternative costs. You can pay additional costs, such as kicker if necessary. If it has any mandatory costs, those must be paid to cast the spell. So same deal as always. You know, you have to pay the full cost of the spell. If the plotted card has X in its mana cost, you must choose X as the value of X when casting it without paying its mana cost. You're not paying for it. You can't actually contribute towards it. So you have to choose X as zero. Modal double face cards.
Yeah.
Well, I don't see anything in the release notes about it. I'm not sure if that will require a future update. I don't know the answer unless Brian knows some sneaky L5 stuff.
It's just right now, there's nothing in the release notes. What happens is, okay, so modal double face cards can have one cost on the front and another cost on the back. So y'all might remember that Cascade had some problems because there was this whole Valky God of Lies, Tybalt Cosmic Imposter thing, where Tybalt, the front face of the card, is one in a black. And Tybalt Cosmic Imposter was 5 black and a red. And you could Cascade down, hit Valky God of Lies 2, and then cast Tybalt Cosmic Imposter, right? And so they changed the Cascade rules so that you couldn't do that anymore. So there's been a question about, hey, if I am somehow able to plot a Valky God of Lies, and there is a couple ways to do that, would I be able to cast it on a later turn as Tybalt Cosmic Imposter? And right now, all signs, shaking the Magic 8 Ball, all signs point to yes. You will be able to do that. So... have fun.
Saddle up. Things are about to get weird.
The whole Tybalt thing, I'm just reminded of my friend Tony. So that's for you, Tony. I hope you appreciate it.
Yeah. It's not great because you still got to get, in most cases, you still got to get Valky God of Lies on the battlefield to do like Kellen Joins Up or any of that kind of nonsense. But, you know, yeah, good. Have fun.
Somebody's going to break it, or not.
Sure.
So next up, we have saddle. This is a new keyword action. As an example, we have our Drover Grizzly, because we like bears on this podcast. For two and a green, it's a creature bear mount. Mount is a new creature type here. For two, and it says, whenever Drover Grizzly attacks while saddled, creatures you control gain trample until end of turn. And then it has the ability Saddle 1 with the reminder text, tap any number of other creatures you control with total power 1 or more. This mount becomes saddled until end of turn. Saddle only as a sorcery. Sounds pretty familiar to us players who enjoy vehicles and how they work, but the saddle ability is currently on creatures with the mount creature subtype. You can saddle up any permanent. Typically, it's going to be a creature that has a saddle N cost by tapping any number of other untapped creatures you control with total power N or greater. You can overpay for this if you want to for some reason. There might be some cards that want you to. Who knows? That permanent becomes saddled until end of turn. You can activate this only as a sorcery. So that's one big key difference between crewing and saddle. Saddle is specifically only as a sorcery, but really, it's crewing a creature. Saddled isn't an ability that a creature has or gains. It's just something that is true about it. So once you've saddled up onto this mount, that ability of saddle, designation, is just something that is true about the card. It won't stop being saddled until the turn ends or until that object leaves the battlefield. Creatures with saddle can attack or block as normal because they are normal creatures even when they aren't saddled. Remember all those horse decks you had up until now? Still the same kind of deal. If a permanent becomes a copy of a saddled mount, the copy will not be saddled. So that is not something that is copyable. You would have to tap and pay the number of power that is necessary to saddle that creature. And you may activate a permanent's saddle ability even if that permanent is already saddled. And finally, an ability that triggers when a creature attacks while saddled will trigger only if that creature was saddled when it was declared as an attacker. Can't have your cowboy hop up after attackers and still be able to get that trigger. Overall, pretty straightforward. Apparently, this is a mechanic that a lot of people have been asking for over the years, so... All right, mount up. Let's go.
All right, next up is Spree Goblin Nabob. We're going to talk about Requisition Raid is our Spree card that we're choosing. Yep, so Spree is a new mechanic that basically, the way it expresses itself, instead of having an additional cost... Where you pay for a spell, it's got an effect, and then as an additional cost, you can do more and get more. Spree is a mechanic where you have to pay the additional cost, okay? And normally it has different modes, and you can pick. So Requisition Raid costs a single white mana, but up next to the little mana, it's got this little plus sign indicator, okay? And that indicates that you have to choose one or more additional costs, or at least that's what Spree is. So the little plus has no rules meaning other than to remind players that there's at least you got to do at least one additional cost to cast the spell. Okay? So Spree's an ability that, okay, so Requisition Raid for one white with the little plus has Spree. And then you could plus one colorless mana, destroy target artifact. So I can pay one and a white to destroy target artifact. Or plus one, destroy target artifact enchantment. Destroy target enchantment. Or plus one, put a plus one counter on each creature target player controls. Now, I've been saying or, but it's really and or. So I can... choose all modes. So for one, a single white, plus one, plus one, plus one, I can destroy target artifact, destroy target enchantment, and put a plus one counter on each creature, target player, me, controls. I'm probably going to target me. I mean, I could target my opponent because I might want to commit a crime, but the real crime is them waiting while I take all my little dice and try and turn and find the find the additional, you know, one higher number on every single one of my dice. That's the real crime. Okay. So you must choose at least one of the modes listed and pay the associated cost. You must choose the modes as you cast a spell with Spree. So if we remember our steps in casting a spell, choosing modes is the thing you do right before you declare targets, because in the case like this, I got to know how many targets I need to declare before I can declare them. If that mode does require a target, I can only select it if there's a legal target available, so I cannot destroy target artifact if there are no artifacts. Okay? You can't cast Requisition Raid for just a white, just to get your storm count up. Okay, the little plus means you gotta pay an additional cost. I'm hammering that out. However, if you have something like an Isochron Scepter, all right, you can put some Spree cards under the Isochron Scepters. Just when you copy it and cast it, you gotta pay the additional cost. Just a little tip. Okay, let's see here. No matter which mode you choose, you're always going to resolve the instructions in the order that they're written on the card. We all know that. We've been doing modal cards for forever now. You cannot choose the same mode more than once. That is going to be a common question. Then the mana value of a spell with Spree is determined only by its mana cost in the upper right corner. Okay? It does not care about which modes you choose or additional costs you pay. Just what the card says. So Disdainful Stroke will do nothing against your fully loaded Requisition Raid, but Minor Misstep will. All
right. Load up on those Minor Missteps.
Yep. And because this is when you are casting spells, or when you are casting the spell is when you are, you know, determining the additional costs and declaring targets, there is no player can cast spells or activate abilities while you are choosing your modes. And when the spell goes to resolve and you are going through the modes, boom, 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 players don't get an opportunity to do anything in between them either. Wow, there's a lot. If a spell with Spree is copied, the effect that creates the copy may allow you to choose new targets, okay? But you can't use new modes, okay? So the modes are locked in. So if you copy a Spree, you just get those modes, all right? If all the targets of the chosen modes become illegal before the spell with Spree is resolved, the spell won't resolve and none of the effects are going to happen, even if some of them don't have targets. All right. And then if an effect allows you to cast a spell with Spree without paying its mana cost, like Plot, okay, you must still choose at least one mode and you have to pay the additional cost for that mode. So you don't get a Spree spell for free. You don't get to Spree for free. Savvy?
Seems like it.
Okay.
That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot for a very simple design, but yeah, that's a lot.
The nice thing is that I think it's largely intuitive. Graphically, I have a minor gripe, but I mean, it's a neat thing that they did, and I'm encouraged by the development of this new space. So,
yeah,
cool. This is the
mechanic. I look at this and I'm like, okay, this is fine.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
It's fancy modes. It's a buffet of modes.
It's a buffet.
Buffet.
Oh, you know what my favorite part of a buffet is?
Oh, geez, you're going there.
Dessert. Dessert. Desserts are back. Desserts are tasty. Or, wait, no. Sorry, there's one S. It's deserts are back. Okay, that's more boring. Anyways, deserts are back. I will commit to the bit every time. Get ready.
Yeah, get wrecked too.
Yeah.
Wait, isn't this Charles's turn?
Oh, I can have it now? Okay. Deserts are back. No, deserts are back. Yeah, you got me doing it. Desert is a land subtype with no special meaning. It doesn't grant any intrinsic mana abilities. Other cards may care about which lands are deserts. Notably, they are not delicious. I don't know why we say that. We have to clarify that. But desserts are not delicious. They need an extra S to be delicious.
Do not eat the delicious cards.
Do not eat the delicious cards. Enemy Fastlands are also getting a reprint in this set. So if one of these Fastlands enters the battlefield at the same time as one or more other lands, it doesn't take those other lands into consideration when determining how many other lands you control. I'm looking at you, Primeval Titan, apparently. But basically, these cards look at the battlefield to see if there is another land, basic land type, already on the battlefield. If there is, then it comes in upright. If there is no, or vice versa, whichever it is. One way it'll come in tapped, one way it'll come in untapped, depending on what's already on the battlefield. So, you know, if everything's coming in at the same time, it sees nothing on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Shall we do the cards?
I think we should do the cards.
Because
we have a lot of them to do tonight.
Yeah. All right. All right. Hat count. What's our hat count at?
Right now it's at 1.
Is it?
Yep. That's a hat.
Vile Smasher had a hat.
Oh, well, okay, sure. Hold on, let me scroll back, because we've got hats in requisition.
Okay, range. Fine, just card by card, we'll do hat count of 1 right now.
Yeah.
Hat count of 1.
Hat count on 1.
Okay.
So wait, Charles, are you saying the count is at 1?
The count is at 1.
Excellent. All right, so let's get through this in a flash. We have Annie Flash, the Veteran, for 3 red, green, and a white. It is a 4/5 legendary creature human rogue with Flash. When Annie Flash, the Veteran, enters the battlefield, if you cast it, return target permanent card with mana value 3 or less from your graveyard to the battlefield, tapped. Whenever Annie Flash becomes tapped, exile the top 2 cards of your library. You may play those cards this turn. So a few things here. Annie's second ability does not care which zone you cast it from. It only checks to make sure that Annie Flash was cast. So any ability or effect that lets you cast a card from the graveyard will work for this. Pass the sniff test, no problem. But if you cheat out Annie without casting her, then the trigger is not going to happen. Permanents are artifacts, battles, creatures, enchantments, lands, and planeswalkers. If the mana cost of a spell in your graveyard has an X in its cost, X is going to equal 0. This is going to come up a lot in this set, where if you're casting something without paying for it and it has X, X is 0. We're going to say that like once or twice at the top, and we're just going to skip it from then on. Also, if you return an aura using the ability, you choose a target as that aura enters the battlefield. Since the aura isn't actually targeting, it will be able to get around things like Hexproof or Shroud or Ward. The recipient of the aura must still be a legal dance partner. So if the recipient has protection from red and the aura has a red mana value, then it's not going to work out for you, Buckaroo. I can't believe you made me say that. If there is no legal card for the aura to enchant, it never leaves the graveyard. Is this you getting back at me for the show notes last time?
Literally, this is the only thing, and I didn't know who was going first. So, I mean, I was hoping I was actually getting Brian, to be honest. But
you can choose to not say the words in the show notes. You can say other words.
No.
I told you, Brian. That I commit to the bit.
You're not locked in.
These have to be said.
I am locked in. Like all the costs and timing restrictions of cards that you play from exile using Annie's last ability. So if the exiled card is a sorcery, it may only be played anytime you could cast a sorcery. Like that segue there? Yeah? Yeah? I'm done.
Yeah? Okay. Are you okay? Are you okay, Annie? All right. Next card is Annie Joins Up. Hat count
2.
Okay. Annie Joins Up is for 1, a red, a green, and a white. It's a legendary enchantment. When Annie Joins Up enters the battlefield, it deals 5 damage to target creature or planeswalker an opponent controls. You commit a crime! If a triggered ability of a legendary creature you control triggers, that ability triggers an additional time. All right. Reminders, triggered abilities, magic words are when, whenever, and at. Let's see here. Replacement effects are unaffected by Annie's second, or Annie joins up second ability. So if you have an ability that has the words instead or skip or this permanent enters with, you know, you just don't get that the second time. Annie joins up's final ability doesn't copy the triggered ability. It causes it to happen a second time. Okay, so you get choices that were made when the ability went on the stack. You get to make new choices. Okay. Now, this one is a little bit weird. This one is one that kind of stumbles people up. So we're going to use a non-legendary creature as an example for this. So we'll just play pretend. So if a triggered ability of a creature you control triggers again, that ability triggers an additional time. For a card like Elite Arcanist, and we seem to be talking about this card a lot in Release Notes episodes now, says, whenever Elite Arcanist enters the battlefield, you may exile an instant card from your hand. Okay, with Annie joins up, that is going to trigger twice. You can say, like, well, that kind of sucks. I'm just exiling an instant card from my hand. Well, Elite Arcanist has an ability, X, tap, copy the exiled card. You may cast the copy without paying its mana cost. X is the mana value of the exiled card. Okay, but in this case, those are linked abilities. The exiling a card from your hand and then being able to copy it. But I got the trigger twice. So how do I do that? Well, in this particular case, in the case of Elite Arcanist, X is going to be the sum of the mana costs, or the mana values of the both exiled cards, and then when you pay it and you get to copy the exiled cards, you can choose one, both, or none. Okay.
Seems real good.
Yeah. Now here's another thing that I saw a question just today, and I was like, hey, this is a pretty good question, so this merits. There are some cards. There are triggered abilities that set up a reflexive trigger in the ability itself. Okay, so it's like, you know, when this creature attacks, you know, you can pay one. When you do, blah, 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 do something awesome. Okay, and you say like, okay, well, that the first thing is when this attacks, okay, I'm gonna get that twice. And then I pay the one, do I get the reflexive trigger twice also? So, or not actually twice, do I get it four times? Do I get to copy, you know, I get it, and then I get to copy it again? Triggered again. Did I explain that right? Because when I have a triggered ability with a reflexive trigger inside it, when that triggered ability triggers and the reflexive ability triggers, does that also trigger twice? So I get a total of four reflexive triggers. And the answer to that question is no. Okay. Because the reflexive trigger is embedded within the larger triggered ability. So it's not a triggered ability itself. It is a trigger that is being created by another trigger. Okay.
That's a good one.
Yay. Yeah. All right. Cool.
Well, okay. I think it's time for a hat count. We're looking at another round, and I'm looking at the card art, and I am perplexed because it does say another round, and I just don't see a saloon anywhere, and I am confused and saddened. But there's also no hats. So,
well,
that cactus in the background
is not wearing a hat.
I would argue that the shadows are deliberately vague.
Yes. Who knows what the hat count is, but we're going to go with, because we don't see a physical hat, the hat count is still at two.
Okay. It's a spiritual hat, though.
No. It still doesn't.
We're not tracking that.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have another round, which for 2X, 2 and a white is a sorcery. That says, exile any number of creatures you control, then return them to the battlefield under their owner's control. Then repeat this process X more times. Okay. So, if X is zero, then you exile the creature and return it. Then you stop right there. There's no... Or exile the creatures and return it. Then you stop there. There's no repeat action. You can choose the same or different creatures each time that you repeat. There's no requirement either way. If you choose some one time, you can choose different ones the next time. And then if you do it a third time, you can go back to the ones you did it the first time. Whatever you want to do is fine. When an exiled creature returns to the battlefield, it is a new object because they are being exiled. So they're changing zones. It has no relation to its previous incarnation or is attached to creatures exiled go to their owner's graveyards. Equipment becomes unattached when creatures are exiled and counters disappear. Tokens exiled this way cease to exist. Remember, they're changing zones. They're going to exile and then poof, they're gone. It's sad, but you know, we'll get over it. Abilities that trigger when a creature enters or leaves will trigger each time a creature enters or leaves. Weirdly enough, if these abilities require targets, you won't choose them until after another round finishes resolving and they go on the stack. Okay. So if you're doing, you know, repeat three times, it all goes on the stack after you're done. All abilities that trigger as a result of another round resolving only are put on the stack after another round finishes resolving. All such abilities are put on in APNAP order. We all know that song and dance, but it's active player, then non-active player. And if in your multiplayer, you go around in a circle from active player to non-active 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 player because you're playing Emperor and you don't like fun. Each player may put abilities on the stack in the order of their choosing. Abilities don't have to be on the stack in the order they were triggered because they're all basically happening at the same time. Fun.
That is pretty cool. I have no segue for this one, although the art on this next card looks absurd.
You can't do a Monty Python reference? She turned me into a newt. There you go.
I got better. Yeah,
there you go.
Got it.
So we have the newt that we were turned into before we got better. This is Archmage's Newt for one and a blue. It's a 2/2 creature salamander mount. So you can ride this newt. How big is this newt? Anyways, whenever Archmage's Newt deals combat damage to a player, target instant or sorcery card in your graveyard gains flashback until end of turn. The flashback cost is equal to its mana cost. That card gains flashback 0 until end of turn instead if Archmage's Newt is saddled. So you may cast that card from your graveyard for its flashback cost and exile it as the reminder text for flashback, and then it has saddle 3. So, reminder for everyone, everybody's favorite mechanic, flashback cost means you may cast this card from your graveyard by paying that cost rather than paying its mana cost, and if the flashback cost was paid, exile this card instead of putting it anywhere else anytime it would leave the stack. So whether it's countered, whether it resolves, whatever, it poof goes to exile. Then, timing restrictions and permissions are not bypassed by flashback, so you can only cast a sorcery when a sorcery would normally be able to be cast, typically when the stack is empty and on your turn. The total cost of a spell is determined by the mana cost or alternative cost, such as flashback, that you're paying. Add cost increases and then subtract cost reductions. The mana value of the spell is still only determined by the mana cost that's on the card itself. A spell cast using flashback is always exiled afterwards. Doesn't matter if it resolves, if it leaves the stack in some other way, maybe it goes on an adventure, whatever it is, it's exiled afterwards. A spell can be targeted for this effect so long as it is in your graveyard. How it got there does not matter. So you don't have to have cast and resolve a spell that was in your graveyard. You can have milled it earlier. You could discard it because someone committed a crime on you and made you discard your card by targeting you. Whatever it is, if it's in your graveyard, you can give it flashback. If you cast an instant or sorcery using flashback and X is in the mana cost, you choose the value for X while casting and paying for the spell. If the spell has flashback 0 because of that saddle ability, you can't choose a value for X other than 0. Still has to be that. Casting a spell with flashback does not allow you to choose to pay alternative costs beyond the flashback cost, because flashback is the alternative cost that you've chosen. So you can't overload that Cyclonic Rift in your graveyard for 0. Must be nice. Hopeful. Nice dreams. Can't do it. You can pay kicker costs, however, and if the spell has any mandatory costs associated with it, for instance, sacrificing a creature, you do have to pay those costs as well. If a card ends up having multiple flashback costs, because flashback is everywhere, you can choose any of the flashback costs that it has in order to cast the spell from your graveyard. And if a card with no mana cost gains flashback equal to its mana cost, it has no flashback cost. It cannot be cast. So what we're talking about here are like those suspend cards that don't have a mana cost in the upper right corner. If there's nothing for it to gain there, it's null. It's not 0. It's just non-existent, and therefore it can't gain nothing. So can't do that. Whew.
All right. Hat count 3. Assimilation Aegis. For 1, a white and a blue, we have an artifact equipment. All right. It says when Assimilation Aegis enters the battlefield, exile up to 1 target creature until Assimilation Aegis leaves the battlefield. Okay. That's pretty good. Just the equipment itself is going to exile a target creature. Cool. And then whenever Assimilation Aegis becomes attached to a creature, for as long as Assimilation Aegis remains attached to it, that creature becomes a copy of a creature card exiled with Assimilation Aegis. Equipped
what?
2. This is... So you get
that's
to steal
nuts.
your opponent's best creature, essentially. Yeah, all right. Okay, I'll tell you what. I actually like this card.
That's okay. Really good.
You like? I'm just saying, Brian, you know, my little Grinch heart just grew like a half a size. All right, so... If Assimilation Aegis, so this first ability says when Assimilation Aegis enters the battlefield, exile up to 1 target creature card until Assimilation Aegis leaves the battlefield. So right off, if Assimilation Aegis leaves the battlefield before the first ability resolves, the creature will not be exiled at all. You still committed a crime, but the ability will not resolve, okay? If you somehow exile multiple cards with the same Assimilation Aegis ability, you got something that copies the trigger or causes the trigger to trigger again, okay, you're going to exile 2 cards. And then whenever Assimilation Aegis becomes attached to a creature, you're going to get to pick which exiled creature card your cowboy gets to copy, all right? If you somehow exile a non-creature card with the ability, so like an animated land or something like that, you can't choose to have the attached creature become a copy of that card. Okay. Because it says like Assimilation Aegis remains attached to it. That creature becomes a copy of a creature card exiled with Aegis. So even though it was a creature when you exiled my creature land, it stopped being a creature in exile, and so I can't make it a copy, okay? The attached creature, when it becomes a copy, you don't get things like whether or not the creature was suspected or saddled or crude or monstrous or any of these other, like, invisible indicators that we've got now. And none of the visible indicators either, the +1/+1 counters. Let's see here. Any non-copy effects applied to that creature before it becomes a copy. It's hit with a card that says, like, you know, this creature becomes 1/1 until the end of turn. Okay. And then I attach Assimilation Aegis to that creature. It's going to become a copy, but that's in layer 1. Then we're going to run through. I still have an effect that says its power and toughness is being set to 1/1. So I will have a, you know, 1/1 Lord of the Pit or whatever, you know, fun card you copied. When you become a copy of a creature, you are not entering the battlefield or leaving the battlefield or any of that stuff. You're just becoming something else.
Cool.
That's legit. Yeah.
So hat count is at 4... then 5, because at knife point has 2 hats in the art, and we're going to count every last one of them, at least until the bit goes stale. So at knife point, for one, a black and a red is an enchantment, and it has the following text. As long as it's your turn, outlaws you control have first strike. So reminder, that's assassins, mercenaries, pirates, rogues, and warlocks. Whenever you commit a crime, create a 1/1 red mercenary creature token with the ability tap : target creature you control gets +1/+0 until end of turn. Activate only as a sorcery. This ability triggers only once each turn. So there's no way to have this card leave the battlefield after first strike damage happens and have it give outlaw creatures a chance to do normal damage as well. Nope. Just stop it. Really, that's not how combat works.
Hey. Oh, this is me, isn't it?
Well, somebody should do it.
We'll see.
I'm trying to interrupt you.
You good, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm good. I was trying to interrupt you.
All right, that beats any segue I was trying to come up with. We have Brian, who is apparently an Aven interrupter.
Hey, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Interrupting cow.
No!
I let him do it to me, folks. I know the joke.
Yeah.
But well, you're a parent. You're dead. Great.
Had to be done.
Yeah.
All right, so we have the Aven Interrupter. This is a for one white and a white. We have a 2/2 creature bird rogue with flash and flying. When Aven Interrupter enters the battlefield, exile target spell. It becomes plotted, so its owner may cast it as a sorcery on a later turn without paying its mana cost. Spells your opponents cast from graveyards or from exile cost 2 generic mana more to cast, and the hat count is still at 5. So this is a really interesting card. Interacts really interestingly with certain cards. For example, spells that can't be countered, they can still be affected by this Aven Interrupter because the action of exiling them and plotting them is not countering the spell. Countering means stopping it from resolving. So even though the targeted spell won't resolve, it's not doing it because it was countered. It was just put somewhere else instead of going to go to try to resolve. If the player who exiled the spell casts the plotted version, it has no memory of any of the choices that were made by the original controlling player. So really what this means is it's back to square one. You get to start casting the spell again, and you can make new choices. You can choose different modes, different targets. It's not tied at all to what it used to be. And this is just my reminder, because this was tripping me up as we were writing the show notes. Remember that when you cast these, even if you put an instant into exile as a plotted card, plot only allows you to cast it as a sorcery. So be aware of that.
It does not have plot armor.
Thank you for getting that in there.
Thank you.
Got there. Yes. I feel like such an outcast.
I was going to say Brian should be outcast for that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that works too.
That's fine. Then you can do the next card. No, we're doing hat count. We're up to hat count 6, y'all, with Beast Bond Outcaster. That's right. Hat count 6 is 2 and a green for a creature human druid. When Beast Bond Outcaster enters the battlefield, if you control a creature with power 4 or greater, draw a card. All right. You know what we haven't done in a while is our intervening if clause trigger count. So we are now at intervening if clause trigger count 1. All right. Let's talk about how intervening if clause triggers work. So we have when Beast Bond Outcast enters the battlefield, comma, if condition, which is if you control a creature with power 4 or greater, comma, draw a card. That's my intervening if clause, because otherwise it would just be When Beast Bond Outcaster enters the battlefield, draw a card. Them little comma things. Okay, so what's so great about intervening if clauses, other than the fact that they cause problems, is that is a condition that has to be true both when the trigger is put on the stack and when the ability goes to resolve. Okay, so that means, in order for this trigger to go on the stack, when it enters the battlefield, you have to control a creature with power 4 or greater. And that's just to go on the stack. Then a bunch of stuff can happen. You know, it's on the stack. Stack does stack things. then the ability goes to resolve, it's going to check again to see if you control a creature with power 4 or greater. It doesn't have to be the same creature, but it has to be. But you have to have a creature with power 4 or greater. If that's not true in either going on the stack or resolving, you ain't going to get to draw a card. And it has plot 1 and a green, so you know you can tailor this a little bit to when you can cast it. Oh, and it's a 3/3. Not that that's, you know, relevant.
You never know. I mean, it could happen that, you know, when it comes down to the big fight at the vault, the 3/3s
matter. You're really stretching there.
Hey, look, I've got three characters in front that are betrayed at the vault. I mean, we got to talk about some kind of a fight or something, conflict that's happening there. I think that's reasonable. I think that's a reasonable one. You have to give that one to me just a little bit. Anyway, hat count is at 8 because there are two characters with hats on and it's not naming a character. So we're just going to go to 8. Betrayal at the vault for 4 and 2 green is an instant. And it has the text, target creature you control deals damage equal to its power to each of 2 other target creatures. So in a situation where the caster's target creature leaves the battlefield before Betrayal of the Vault resolves, the spell does nothing and no damage is dealt because there's nothing to deal damage. If one of the creatures targeted to be dealt damage leaves the battlefield before Betrayal resolves, the spell still does damage to the other creature targeted. If both happen to leave the battlefield before Betrayal resolves, the spell again really does nothing. Remember, this is a punch, not a fight, so the damage is not reciprocal.
All right.
Oh, wait. I missed hats.
Yeah, I corrected for one of the hats. I was just zooming in on the card art to see if there was another one in the background.
Okay, good.
But I it's not clear as to whether or not that is or is not a hat, so we'll give them... We won't tick the hat count up one. Are we clear?
Isn't there a blue cow in American Mythos?
Well, there's the blue cows that make the blue milk that Luke Skywalker drinks.
No, that's but there is a nasty.
There's a blue ox.
Blue ox, mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, so that must be what the callback is too.
Yes, by Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
Yes, the very on the nose Paul Bunyan character. We have Bonnie Paul, Clear Cutter. I am so excited for this card for Amulet Titan specifically. I saw this card and I just squealed. So I'm excited to talk about it. For 3, a green and 2 blue. So 3 green, blue, 6 mana total. For a 6/5 legendary creature, Giant Scout. Bringing our hat total up to 10 now. This creature has reach. And it says when Bonnie Paul Clearcutter enters the battlefield, create Bow, a legendary blue ox creature token. With this creature's power and toughness are each equal to the number of lands you control.
Instead of Babe the Blue Ox, it's Bo the Blue Ox.
Yeah. Babe, Bo, same. It's very on the nose, but yeah. I'm all right with it. And then it has another ability. Whenever you attack, draw a card, then you may put a land card from your hand or graveyard onto the battlefield. Really cool ability. I can't wait to talk about this in Modern, but let's talk about the card. Now, talking about Bo the Ox... Bo the Ox's power and toughness will change as the number of lands that you control changes. So let's say you have 3 damage on your bow, because it just fought our 3/3 from our last example, and I control 4 lands, and then I sacrifice one of those lands, a strip mine or something, to blow up your land, I'm then going to also blow up my ox friend, which is sad. Putting a land onto the battlefield with Bonnie Paul's last ability does not count as playing a land. So you can put a land onto the battlefield even if you've already played your land for the turn or otherwise used up all of your land drops for the turn. Looking at you, Amulet players, hit me up. Is this being added to the ranks? Because if so, I need to go get like 8 copies, some of them in foil. This is really cool. I love it. It does everything. I love it. Did I say I love it yet? I don't know.
Well, you said you love it.
It's a really cool card for the deck.
Yeah. All right. Boneyard Desecrator. For 3 and a black, it is a creature zombie mercenary, a 3/4 zombie mercenary that has, when this enters the battlefield, increase the hat count to 11.
Yes. I got real issues for a second.
Yep. Because... It doesn't have an ETB. It just says menace. Okay, so it says menace. And for one and a black, sacrifice another creature. Put a +1/+1 counter on Boneyard Desecrator. If an outlaw was sacrificed this way, create a treasure token. The ability on the card uses the last known information to resolve. So this right here, it's going to, if you sacrificed like a card that was a clone of something and it was an outlaw, but when it's in the battlefield, it's no longer an outlaw. We are going to look at what it was while it was on the battlefield. That's it.
That's easy.
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry. The pause was, I read it and I was like, what? Yeah. And then I went to the release notes to see if the release notes had any additional information, and it's not in the release notes. And that threw me for a loop. So anyway.
So moving on, rounding up, you know, Brimstone Roundup. For one and a red, it brings our hat count to 15. Wow.
So many hats.
It's an enchantment. Whenever you cast your second spell each turn, create a 1/1 red mercenary creature token with tap : target creature you control gets +1/+0 until end of turn, activate only as a sorcery, and it has plot 2 and a red. So, if spells were cast before Brimstone enters the battlefield, they count toward the total number of spells cast that turn. Also, if Brimstone was the first spell cast in the turn, then the next spell cast is the second one that turn. It's weird that plot is 2 and a red, and the actual casting cost is 1 and a red, but what it's trying to do is it's helping you set up for a bigger turn. That's why there's the increased cost there. Neat little spell. And it has lightning bolts in the background, so we're cool.
All right, so we have the ever-imposing two things you hate to find in the desert, plants that are poking you with little needles and spiders. So we have the Cactarantula for 4 green. This actually brings up the hat count to 18 now. I didn't see those 3 little guys up in the front little bottom corner because I was so distracted by the giant cactus spider. Anyways, this is
you know what this is? I don't know if you ever played like D&D or anything like that.
Yeah.
Have you ever experienced like the box text where it reads like, you open the door and enter into a 30 by 30 room with stone pillars reaching up to a ceiling 15 feet high. Tapestries adorn the walls depicting various scenes of battle. There's a light dripping sound and the air is very humid. And there's an adult red dragon that's attacking you. And you're just like, what? Why would I be paying attention to tapestries when that's happening? So this has the same, like, why am I paying attention to hats when there's a giant cactus spider in my face?
Yeah, that thing looks gnarly. That might be my favorite art from the set so far. Holy cow. Oh, man. All right, so this is the Cactarantula. 4 green for a 6/5 creature plant spider. This spell costs 1 generic mana less to cast if you control a desert. It has reach, and whenever Cactarantula becomes the target of a spell or ability an opponent controls, you may draw a card. So, when you cast Cactarantula, opponents do not have the ability to remove your desert you control from play to prevent you from getting the discount. This has to do with the steps to casting a spell. When you're casting the spell, it's announced, it's paid for, and put onto the stack. And part of that is determining the cost, which counts what you have on the battlefield before anybody else gets a chance to do anything about it. Cactarantula will only have its cost reduced by 1, even if you have more than 1 desert. So if you had 4 deserts, you still get a 1 mana discount. The way the phrasing of the ability works, it's only checking if you have a desert, not how many you have. Cactarantula's last ability is a trigger that goes on the stack above the spell that caused it to trigger. So it will allow the player to draw a card even if the spell causing it to go on the stack ends up getting countered, or even if it would destroy the creature, the trigger still happens first, so you'll still get to draw the card. And if a single spell or ability by an opponent targets... It's so hard to say the name of this when it's spelled out. If a single spell or ability by an opponent targets Cactarantula more than once, it will still only allow one card to be drawn. To draw multiple cards, it has to be targeted by multiple spells controlled by an opponent or multiple abilities. And, you know, it's a beefy boy, so it might take multiple spells to take this thing down. So keep that in mind for your pre-releases this weekend.
All right.
You'll have to throw a whole Inferno at it.
We have Calamity Galloping Inferno. But I really want to put, like, Calamity Jones or Calamity Jane or whatever.
Calamity Ganon.
Just this is Calamity Jones Galloping Inferno. the horse mount is on fire and being ridden by a burning spirit, so the hat count is not increased. But Calamity Galloping Inferno is 4 red red for a 4/6 legendary creature horse mount. It's okay. It has haste. It has saddle 1, which will be relevant in just a second, so I can tap a whole bunch of creatures to saddle up my Galloping Inferno. And whenever Calamity Galloping Inferno attacks while saddled, choose a non-legendary creature that saddled it this turn and create a tapped and attacking token that's a copy of it. Sacrifice that token at the beginning of the next end step. Repeat this process once. Okay? So ultimately, you're going to get 2 copies. Okay? They're both going to be tapped and attacking, and you are going to have to sacrifice both of them at the beginning of the next end step. Okay, when you do repeat this process, you may choose a different creature. So if you saddled up with more than one creature, you don't have to, because it's just saddle 1. But if you did, you can choose a different creature. Okay, each of the tokens is going to copy what was printed on the original creature. Unless modified by other copy effects. If the copy creature has X in its mana cost, X is going to be 0, so you don't want to necessarily do a bunch of Hydras. If the copied creature is a token, the newly created token copies the characteristics of the token, as stated by the effect that created the token. If any ETBs of the copied creature token... Any enters the battlefield effects of the copied creature trigger when the tokens enter the battlefield. Any replacement effects dictating out and changing how it enters the battlefield are also going to be the thing. Do the thing. Let's see here. Okay. Now, these tokens are put onto the battlefield tapped and attacking, but there was never a point where they were declared as attackers. So they never attacked. Okay. So, anyway, in multiplayer games, what's that?
Sad. So sad.
Yep. And in multiplayer games, you choose which opponent is being attacked by the tokens when they enter the battlefield. You don't have to deal with any attacking restrictions or pay any additional costs because you're slipping these in underneath the radar. Calamity Galloping Inferno is just trampling over all those restrictions and requirements and like, I don't care. I'm putting copies of creatures, flaming creatures on the battlefield. Yeehaw.
We got a yeehaw out of him.
We did.
I mean,
he's getting into the spirit. It will happen.
No. Calamity Galloping Inferno is a fun card name to say.
That is true.
And it reminds me of Ghost Rider. So that's cool.
Cactarantula is not a fun... That's like SAT word right there. That's homework.
Yeah, it felt a little... It felt a little caustic.
So from Happy Fire Horse to Weird and Distraught and Scary Sneck Horse, we have Caustic Bronco for 1 and a black. It is a 2/2 creature, and I've never said this before in my life, and I don't expect to ever say it again. Snake Horse Mount. When Caustic Bronco attacks, reveal the top card of your library and put it into your hand. You lose life equal to that card's mana value if Caustic Bronco isn't saddled. Otherwise, each opponent loses that much life, and it has saddle 3. So, God, let's just look at that art for a second. I want to avert my gaze. Now that we've reflected, it is. It really is. Let's review a few things. If the revealed card has no mana cost, lands, for instance, the mana value is 0. If the mana value of the card revealed has X in its cost, X is 0. We know that song, right, Marcus?
What?
Yeah, imagine that. If the revealed card is a split card, the mana value is the combined cost of both sides of the card. So if it has, you know, 1 in a red and 5 in a blue, it would be carry the 1, 8, right? 8.
Yeah,
if the equine snack isn't on the battlefield when the trigger resolves, it uses last known information to check if it was saddled or not before leaving the battlefield to determine who loses life. Yeah, that's Snake Horse, and no offense to the artist, but I could really just never see that again and be happy.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm not going to explain where I'm going with this.
But oh, good.
Is this Snake Horse, is it a reptile or is it a mammal?
It's reptile.
Oh, God.
It's a reptile. You say it's a reptile.
I would 100% go with reptile, with the exception of the hooves, which are a problem. But it is...
Oh, that's what the problem is?
It's definitely... Well, I mean, it's snake head, scales...
Okay.
Reptilian tail.
What I mean...
Oh, thank you for that. That scared the crap out of me.
It does have hooves.
I don't know. This body looks very warm-blooded. But anyway... No, for fans of Brennan Lee Mulligan, you understand where I'm going, and we can just move on to the next card.
I love Brennan Lee Mulligan.
Horrific.
All right. Such a ruckus. Let's move away from that terrifying image that somebody just blew up in our Google Doc that we're reviewing here and scared the crap out of me by. And let's move on to a demonic ruckus for 1 and a red. We have a hat count of 19. There are so many teeny little hats stuck in the art here. Oh, my goodness. We have a demon flailing around, and there's a cowboy just in awe of this giant demon. Is that Rakdos? That is Rakdos, right? I think that's Rakdos.
We'll go with that.
Yeah. Anyways, so Demonic Ruckus is 1 in red for an enchantment aura with enchant creature. Enchanted creature gets +1/+1 and has menace and trample. And when Demonic Ruckus is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, draw a card. And it has plot for a single red mana. Now, if Devil Disturbance or Demonic Ruckus's target is illegal when it goes to resolve, like it's been removed from the battlefield, it has protection from red, it gains, you know, Shroud or something like that, then the aura goes from the stack to the graveyard. Does not pass go, it does not collect $200, and the trigger from going from the graveyard to or put into the graveyard from the battlefield never happens because it never was on the battlefield to leave the battlefield to cause that trigger to happen. Pretty straightforward.
Yep. Now I'm gonna need a ruling.
Yeah, flavor judge ruling.
Dr.
Flavor Judge Chasko.
All right, we're about to do the card Double Down.
So explain the problem and I'll explain the ruling.
There is a woman wearing a trench coat looking thing, but also a pink hat. And
so
there
it's Carmen Sandiego.
Carmen Sandiego. Yes. Is it? Okay. I get me. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of okay. Carmen Sandiego looking. That's the first thing I thought of.
Okay, so there is a mirror with her wearing a hat, and then another mirror with her wearing the hat, and another reflection. I'm going to have to argue that these... Well, anyway, there's a woman wearing a hat and 3 reflections of her wearing the hat.
Yes.
Is that 1 hat or 3 or 4 hats?
It's 1 physical hat, so we're going to count it as 1.
Really? But someone drew 4 hats.
Well, they wasted a lot of time and effort, I think, but, you know, whatever. It makes them happy.
Yeah.
They can draw all the hats they want. I'm still counting it as one.
I would also argue that I don't think the reflections can actually work this way, but anyway. Double down. They can't. Three and a blue for double down. It's an enchantment. Whenever you cast an outlaw spell, copy that spell.
How flavorful.
Assassins, mercenaries, pirates, rogues, and warlocks are outlaws. Copies of permanent spells become tokens. All right. Double down's ability and trigger. So this trigger. Go on the stack above the spell that caused it to trigger. The trigger is going to resolve before the spell that caused it to trigger resolves. And if the spell that caused it to trigger is countered, it will still copy the spell. So I cast my outlaw. It's on the stack. Double down triggers. I have an ability that says I'm going to make a copy. Someone counterspells my whatever my creature type that I said was. I'm still going to get my copy, okay? When the copy resolves, if it was a permanent spell, it is going to be put onto the battlefield as a token. You did not create a token. Tokens... That's the next line in the release note, in the notes. Tokens of a resolving copy of a permanent spell are not considered to be created. Abilities that reference a token being created won't interact with a copy resolving.
Sorry, and then, season.
Yep. Double down can and will copy kindred spells. You might be asking yourself, what's a kindred spell? Are we playing Vampire the Masquerade? No, we're playing Magic the Gathering. Kindred spells are the new name for tribal spells. All right. So if you remember, tribal spells, now kindred spells, can have creature types. So you can have kindred instance. That would be a, you know, assassin, mercenary, pirate, rogue. There's also a few kindred spells that have changeling. They're all creature types. So you get to double down all you want. And then double down, however, won't that trigger won't happen if the spell is just cheated into play. You gotta cast it. Okay? So copies that are just made and put onto the stack, no, but copies that are made in exile and then cast, like with Isochron's Scepter. Okay. Those would trigger with double down. So if you were to get a changeling, kindred changeling spell under an Isochron Scepter, you would, and double down, you would have a very bad deck. But you would have a copy of that spell. And a terrible deck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't mind me.
Okay.
All right.
That was easy.
Don't mind you.
Yeah.
So the next card, it does not increase our hat count at all. It remains at 20. It's Duelist of the Mind for one and a blue. It is a star asterisk slash three power or three toughness, creature human advisor. It has flying and vigilance. Duelist of the Mind's power is equal to the number of cards you've drawn this turn. Whenever you commit a crime, you may draw a card. If you do, discard a card. This ability triggers only once each turn. So, Duelist ability is a CDA. It's a character divining ability. And as such, it works from all zones. So, while Nathan, the Duelist, is hiding in exile, he's still peeping at your hand size and basing his power on how many cards you drew this turn. Also, didn't we stop putting magic players on cards? No? Cool. The art is of Nathan Stewart, the world Magic World Champion from 2023. So congratulations, Nathan, on getting your face on a card.
Yeah. I love that they're doing that again. It's very aspirational, even though I know it'll never happen for me. But I can hope and I can dream. I just hope I don't get haunted in those dreams. Like an emergent haunting. Where there's a whole bunch of ghosties floating out of a really wrecked-looking house.
Yeah, those don't look like ghosts. Those don't look like ghosts.
No? What do they look like?
I don't want to keep
spirits. Oh, got it. Yeah, spirits. Right. Got it.
Yep, spirit.
We have no additional hat count here because these spirits are hatless. And let's see, Emergent Haunting, one and a blue for an enchantment. At the beginning of your end step, if you haven't cast a spell from your hand this turn, and Emergent Haunting isn't a creature, it becomes a 3/3 spirit creature with flying in addition to its other types. And it has the ability to pay 2 generic mana and a blue to surveil 1. Now, this is also an intervening if, so everything we talked about with Beastmon Outcaster applies for this as well.
Intervening if count trigger. 2!
Oh, yeah. Intervening if count 2. The count is at 2. and interestingly, this actually checks 2 different things. It casts, it counts whether you've cast a spell from your hand this turn, and it counts whether Emergent Haunting is a creature or not. So both of those have to be not true in order for it to go on the stack and resolve. And also that ability, turning it into a creature, does not have a duration. So once this card has been turned into a creature, it's going to stay that way indefinitely until it goes to another zone or, yeah, that's it. It's a creature now.
All right. Next up is Urtha Joe, Frontier Mentor. The hat count is up to 21 now. While not wearing a hat, it is dangling from a strap from
actually,
Urtha
I think
Joe's
it's
neck.
22. Look at the bottom right 22? Corner.
Oh.
Missed one. My fault.
Charles.
My
Charles.
Fault. I'm trying Charles. To keep up. I really am.
Hold missed on. That is that a guy in the background dropping a hat also?
Yes, he is.
It
That's
is.
24.
Jeez, oh, we're gonna have more hats than more hats 24. Than cards. You know, I made the joke. The only reason they included like bovine intervention and holy cow is so if someone said this set was all hat no cattle, they could be like, no, there's 2 cattle in there. All right,
oh, there's so much cattle.
Yeah, there's so much cattle. All right, but like literal cattle. Anyway, Urtha Joe, Frontier Mentor, 2 red and a white for a 2/4 legendary creature, Core Advisor. Okay, when Urtha Joe, Frontier Mentor, enters the battlefield, create a 1/1 red mercenary creature token with tap target creature you control, gets +1/+0 until end of turn. Activate only as a sorcery. That's all in quotes. It's quote, tap target creature gets blah, 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 activate as a only as a sorcery, end quote. Activate as a sorcery wouldn't make sense as being part of a trigger. Anyway, also, whenever you activate an ability that targets a creature or player, copy that their ability, you may choose new targets for the copy. Whew. So, activated abilities contain a colon. They are normally written as cost effect. Okay, so if there's a colon involved, you're going to have a good time. All right. The source of the copy. Okay, the source of the copy is the same as the source of the original ability. So whenever you activate an ability that targets a creature or player, copy that ability, source is the same. The copy will have the same targets as the ability it's copying unless you choose new ones. So it says you may choose new targets for the copy. If you don't choose new targets, it's going to stay the same. Okay, if you choose new targets, the new targets have to be legal. Quirk in the rules, if you leave the targets alone, those actually can be illegal at that point in time. Yay. If the ability that you are copying is modal, the mode is locked in. You can't change, you can't change the mode. Same thing with if the ability divides damage or distributes counters among any number of targets. The division, like how you split it up. So if the ability's like deals 5 damage amongst any number of targets the way you choose, and you're like, I'm going to do 3 damage to that target and 2 to that, and then you copy it, you are locked into 3 to 1 target and 2 to another, but you can change those targets around. If the ability's cost contains a choice, such as sacrifice a creature, Okay, number of counters to remove, or that the copy uses that same info. So think like Commander Land, card that I'm thinking of is Byron Stout Arm. Is that a sacrifice that ability? Sacrifice another creature. Byron Stout Arm deals damage equal to sacrifice creature's power to target player or planeswalker. All right, that is a ability that targets another creature. You had to sacrifice a creature. This copy is still going to use that creature's power in figuring out how much damage it gets. And the source is still the same, which is Byron Stoutarm, who has lifelink. So, you know, maybe that's a thing to consider doing. Hey, I just made your commander deck for you. Any choices made when the ability resolves won't have been made yet when it's copied. Okay, so if there are choices that have to be made when the ability resolves, those choices, aren't copied, so you get to make those choices then. The copy made by Earth of Joe's triggered ability is created on the stack. It is not activated itself. So even though you are copying an activated ability, it itself is not being activated. And then if an ability is linked to a second ability, copies of that ability are also linked to that second ability. Okay, so if the second ability refers to the exiled card, it refers to all cards exiled by the ability of that copy. For example, if one of the Hell Vault's activated abilities is copied and there are two cards already exiled, they both return when the Hell Vault is put into the graveyard from the battlefield. And the Hell Vault says, it's a 3-mana artifact. It's one tap, exile target creature you control. Then 7-tap, exile target creature you don't control, and then it has a triggered ability that says when Hell Vault is put into the graveyard from the battlefield, return all cards exiled with it to the battlefield under its owner's control. So if you were to activate the second ability, which is 7-tap, exile target creature you don't control, and I'm going to target one of Marcos's creatures, and then I've got Earth of Joe here, and lets me I got an activated ability there. Lets me copy that ability. I'm going to exile another target creature I don't control. I'm going to get one of Charles's creatures. Cool. Then, if my Hell Vault is put into the graveyard from the battlefield, I'm going to get to get both creatures back. Or in this set, critters.
Just for the complete set, can we just call them all critters? I mean, that would be amazing.
I think that's fine. We can for the rest.
We can do that.
For the rest of
Okay.
this.
All
Okay.
right. Home, home on the range, where the Fifflepip has gone and gotten himself lost. You're going to keep that, I know.
Oh, absolutely.
Fifflepip lost on the range for one in blue-blue, is a legendary creature homunculus. It's a 1/1. Fifflepip has ward 2 because he can't even find himself, so how can you actually find him and hit him correctly? You may look at the top card of your library at any time. The top card of your library has plot. The plot cost is equal to its mana cost. You may plot non-land cards from the top of your library. Awesome. While you control Fifflepip, you can look at the top card whenever you want with one restriction, even if you don't have priority. The action doesn't use the stack. Note, editors tell me to stay. Please stop saying, in response, I look at the top of my library, because that's not a thing. Hat count, by the way, is at 25. I'm being also reminded by the editors. Knowing
Aren't,
that,
aren't you,
the, knowing what the, what?
you the editor? Aren't you the editor?
We are all editors, so I am empowering everyone else to be editors while I'm talking. That makes me the narrator. Right? Maybe?
In
I don't know.
in
In
response, please
response?
continue. Yeah, please continue.
Damn you, Brian. Stop encouraging them.
Knowing what the top card of your library is becomes part of the information you have access to, just like you can look at the cards in your hand. This can be especially impactful in CEDH, which I don't know why I care about this anymore because we're talking about CEDH, but here we go anyway. Where you can gain access to a player's private information, including the top card of their library, and while you can't show it to the other players, you can certainly talk about it. So, hey, if you know the information, cool. If you're controlling the other player. If you plot the top card of your library, you must exile that card and pay its plot cost before you may look at the new card on top of your library. This is the restriction we were talking about earlier. So you can't look further down by trying to plot a card you can't pay for yet. If the top card of your library normally has plot, you may plot the card using its own plot cost or the plot cost given by Flippip. Whatever one works out best for you, you can do math, I'm sure. Extra note, if you plot an instant card from the top card of your library, that does not mean you can cast it at instant speed. This is the only reminder I'm going to give you about this, but the whole plot thing happens at sorcery speed all the time. Thank you.
Well done.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. So I'm going to go back to being...
The count said what?
We are at 26.
Okay, I'm going to go back to being an editor now.
Excellent, excellent. Go ahead and edit. And editor, tell me why this centaur has spurs on its hooves. I call shenanigans. I'm just saying. Brian pointed this out to me, and I was very upset when I saw it.
You know, somebody pointed that out in somewhere, and maybe it was Brian pointed it out to me as well. And I didn't really look at it at the time, but now that I'm looking at it, I'm actually pained. I'm pained by that choice.
Are they wearing boots on their hooves? It's not. Yeah.
Is he going to make himself go faster by kicking up? I don't know.
I don't want to think about it that hard. Anyways, Free Strider Commando is the card we're talking about. So you can stare in awe as we are at this centaur with spurs on its hooves. Free Strider Commando for 2 and a green is a creature centaur mercenary for 3 with 3 power, 3 toughness. And it says Free Strider Commando enters the battlefield with 2 +1/+1 counters on it if it wasn't cast or no mana was spent to cast it. It also has plot for 3 and a green. So big thing about this is if you cast it without paying its mana cost, but you paid for additional costs or cost increases, such as from Aven Interrupter or somebody has a Trinisphere out, then it won't enter with those +1/+1 counters. Has to be no mana spent on it for any reason. Whoever started writing that while I was in the middle of reading the creature, damn you. Took everything I had not to break.
Okay, so the next card, I want to take a moment and very clearly enunciate the name. This is Jerolf the Flesh Right. Okay. Jerolf the Flesh Right for 2 and a blue.
What else would it be, Brian?
It's a Flesh Right. I don't know what else. It could be, anyway, for 2 and a blue, we have a 2/3 legendary creature human warlock that says whenever you cast a spell during a turn other than your first spell that turn. So whenever you cast a spell during your turn other than the first spell that turn, create a 2/2 blue and black zombie rogue creature token. Okay, so again, that's a caveat of it's the casting a spell during your turn other than the first spell for that turn. Okay, so you doesn't second or more spells on your turn only. Then whenever a zombie enters the battlefield under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on it for each other zombie that entered the battlefield under your control this turn. If multiple zombies enter the battlefield under your control at the same time, Jerolf's last ability will trigger for each of those zombies, and each of those zombies will see all the other zombies that entered the battlefield, plus any other zombies that entered under your control this turn. So, yay! It's a party whenever the flesh rite's involved.
All I'm going to say is the hat count is at 27.
Okay, good.
And yes, it doesn't advance with my next card. Even though it has many, many heads, there are no extra hats that I can see. We have the Gold Vein Hydra. For X and a green, it is a 0/0 creature Hydra. With those magic words, Vigilance, Trample, and Haste. Oof. Gold Vein Hydra enters the battlefield with X +1/+1 counters on it. When Gold Vein Hydra dies, create a number of tapped treasure tokens equal to its power. And the art is slightly reminiscent of the scene in Jurassic Park where the T-Rex is eating the Jeep. It just makes me think of that for some reason. Anyway, use the power of the creature as it last existed on the battlefield to determine how many tokens to create. Last known information, of course. Example, if you tragic slip, you don't get negative tokens, you just get zero.
Cool.
He's weird looking.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
All right. Y'all ready to settle up and go on a heist? We want to Ocean's 11 this?
I mean, we've been here long enough. I think it's time to heist something.
Yes. Let's heist a train. I've always wanted to do a train robbery. So we have the Great Train Heist for a single red plus, because this is a spell with Spree. This is an instant. And it says Spree plus 2 generic mana and a red. Untap all creatures you control. If it's your combat phase, there is an additional combat phase after this phase. Plus 2 generic mana. Creatures you control get +1/+0 and gain first strike until end of turn. And plus a red mana. Choose target opponent. Whenever a creature you control deals combat damage to that player this turn, create a tapped treasure token. And I see the hat count is currently at, we're going to say 30? It's a little dark in here, but I think we're at 30 here. Is that about right?
Yeah, I looked at it for a minute. I think it's right. I mean, it's a little questionable what the main character is doing there with his hat. I think it's hair. It's kind of hard to tell. So I went with 30.
Okay. I appreciate it. I follow the unjudge, Dr. Judge, doctor. Okay, so this Great Train Heist, the first mode doesn't give you additional main phases. So this means you'll move directly from the end of combat step of your primary combat phase and then go to the beginning of combat step on the next combat phase. The second mode only affects creatures that you control at the time this spell resolves. So creatures that you begin to control later in the turn and any like non-creature permanents that became creatures later on in the turn, like animating a land or awakening that ghostly house that we talked about earlier, they won't get the bonus +1/+0 or gain first strike. And there's no rules note on this next card, but I do want to make a note on this. So if you look in the release notes under Harrier Strix, nothing particularly special about this, but I do want to note that the release notes has some trinket text in there that says Bird Law on Thunder Junction is not governed by reason. And I just want to thank the writers of the release notes for their appreciation of the finer aspects of Bird Law. That's all.
Okay.
Any It's Always Sunny fans?
I've seen some.
There's a whole episode where Charlie just thinks he's a bird lawyer.
Oh.
It's amazing.
Not like, is it like a riff on like Harvey Birdman? Or
no, he like actual bird law.
Okay.
Like around actual birds that are just like flying around in the courtroom. One's under a guy's hat. It's a whole thing.
Okay. All right. So the next card is Hell to Pay. Bring our hat count total to 31, which is X and a red for a sorcery. Hell to Pay deals. You know, I think it's a little bit of a flavor loss that Hell to Pay is not does not have an additional cost.
Or a hairpiece.
Yeah. The toupee, yes. Hell to Pay deals X damage to target creature. That could be a crime. Create a number of tapped treasure tokens equal to the amount of excess damage dealt to that creature this way. Okay, excess damage is defined as the damage that's been dealt to a creature greater than it would be considered lethal damage for that creature. Usually this means damage greater than its toughness, but sometimes damage can be previously marked on a creature, and that's going to change the lethal damage that you need to do. So in some unusual cases, such as Pestilent Spirit, the existence of a card called Pestilent Spirit, Hell to Pay may have Death Touch. So even one damage dealt to a creature from a source with death touch is considered lethal damage. So if Hell to Pay has death touch, then and you set like X to 9, you're getting 8 treasure tokens. Yeah. All right.
Got him.
When you read this card before you go into the rules question or the rules, I do need to ask Flavor Judge a question.
Oh.
Ooh.
Okay.
When I read this card?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So we have Hollow Marauder for 6 and a black. It's a 4/2 creature specter rogue, and it brings our hat count to 32, which is exciting. Okay,
I'd like to interrupt at this point because it was hat related. My comment was hat related.
Yeah.
Why were reflections of hats not counted, but ghost hats are?
Because you can take the ghost hat and put it on my head.
Can you?
Yeah, the ghost has control of its corporal form. It can do whatever it wants.
But wouldn't the hat
I'm just making
disappear
as I
with
go
it?
Along? Just let me do it.
Well, so am I. Let's,
whoa,
let's,
whoa.
Yeah. Wait, did you just say?
I did.
Do we have to bleep something?
You have to bleep me. I'm sorry.
Charles.
It happens.
Featherer.
It happens sometimes.
Charles Doctor. Calamity Featherer.
They do say it happens.
Is his middle name Calamity?
I just want you to know that I did it under duress. Brian was, you know, quite clearly pushing me into a corner. No, just kidding. Anyway,
no one pushes Calamity into a corner. All right, keep going.
Hollow Marauder. This spell costs one less to cast for each creature card in your graveyard. Has flying. And when Hollow Marauder enters the battlefield, any number of target opponents each discard a card. For each of those opponents who didn't discard a card, with mana value 4 or greater, draw a card. Interesting. Okay. So, the first ability doesn't change its mana value, which is always 7. It just reduces the cost to cast it in the steps for checking cost while casting a spell. When its triggered ability resolves, the next target opponent in turn order chooses a card in hand without revealing it. Then each other target opponent in turn order, if any, does the same, all the same way around the table. So the chosen cards are then discarded at the same time. This is important to make sure that nobody in a multiplayer format can gain information about the discarded cards before they make their choice as to what to discard. So, you know, no peeking, no hidden information being revealed. It's just all at once being dropped into the discard. Neat.
Very neat. You know what else is neat?
Hoods aren't hats.
Somehow. Yes. And Jace is back.
Wait, somehow Jace returned?
Jace has returned. Jace has reawoken. Jace is not Phyrexian anymore. There's some stories that explain it. I haven't read them yet, but I hear they're pretty good, actually. I don't know. Some people love them. Some people hate them. It's kind of like Jace. But we have Jace Reawakened for blue. This is a 2-mana planeswalker with 4 abilities. So Jace Reawakened, blue, legendary planeswalker Jace, starting with 3 loyalty. The passive ability says you can't cast this spell, or actually it's not even a passive ability, it's just a restriction on the card. You can't cast this spell during your first, second, or third turns of the game. Aw, so I can't cast my 2-mana planeswalker on turn 2. Sad.
On your opponent's turn 2, if you can figure out a way to do it, you can.
Spoilers. We're getting there. We're getting there. Spoilers. So, Jace has 3 abilities here, plus 1. You draw a card, then discard a card. You plus 1. You may exile a non-land card with mana value 3 or less from your hand. If you do, it becomes plotted. And minus 6. Until end of turn, whenever you cast a spell, copy it. You may choose new targets for the copy. So, first note on here, you can cast Jace Reawakened during another player's first, second, or third turns of the game. If some other effect, such as Vidalcan Orrery, for example, allows you to do that. So, as Brian pointed out, figure out a way, and yeah, you can slam this down on turn 2. You just have to do a little extra legwork to make it happen. Jace Reawakened cares about how many turns you have taken, not necessarily how many turns the game has had. So in case you take an extra turn, then in case you take an extra turn, it doesn't matter. It just cares about how many turns you have taken. And this is some of my favorite lines of reminder or rules. Note is, if the game is restarted by Karn Liberated, you can't cast Jace Reawakened in your first, second, or third turn in the new game. Because it's a new game, you're resetting your turn count, so first, second, or third turn, you still cannot cast Jace there. No shenanigans saying, well, I played like 18 turns in the last game to get this Karn to go ultimate. Nope, can't do it. And the rest of the release notes for Jace cover copying spells, very similar to how we've already talked about quite a lot. But a notable big difference is that the copy made by Jace's last ability is created on the stack, so it's not cast for purposes of things that care about you casting a spell. You just copy the spell on the stack. Brian, do you want to cover Kellen?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Okay, we're just going to mention the fact I don't particularly care for... You know what? Hold on, I'm going to back up. You know, for those of you that have read the Wheel of Time series, okay, you know that the middle books are kind of a slog, and a lot of the chapters are point of view chapters, and a lot of times you'll just start reading it, and there's just storylines that you don't care about a whole lot. Like, anything involving the Bowl of the Winds, and I realize this is kind of a deep cut for Robert Jordan fans out there, but on your second or third read through, you just skip whole chapters because why? Why bother? That's kind of what I feel about any part of the story or cards involving Kellen or Kellen the Kid or whatever. This is the end of his story. I'm glad Wizards finally got it out their system. Quit trying to make Kellen happen. All right. Luxurious Locomotive is a 5-mana artifact vehicle for 6... it's a 6/5 vehicle for 5 mana. Hat count is still 32, by the way. Whenever Luxurious Locomotive attacks, create a treasure token for each creature that crewed it this turn. Crew of one, activate only once each turn.
Ah.
Okay, so you may tap more creatures than necessary. Okay, so this is the card, actually, that I was thinking about where I was like, there was something about doing it only once per turn. So this is not a card that, and I think they have this rule so that it prevents some sort of like combo engine where you crew one and then like you're able to like turn into like multiple attacks or something like that. Anyway, you may tap more creatures than necessary to activate the crew ability. So I can tap like 5 creatures and then when I attack, I'm going to create 5 treasure tokens. Okay, once a player announces that they are activating a crew ability, no player may take other actions until the ability has been paid for. Okay, so you can't try and stop the ability by messing with the power of your opponent's creatures or removing the creatures before they get to crew it. So if I say I'm crewing and I'm paying the cost of like tapping 6 things, that's it. You can't interact with that. And then the triggered ability counts each creature that crewed it this turn. Including creatures that are no longer on the battlefield as the ability resolves. Okay, so if you crewed it with 5 creatures, it sees 5 even if 4 of them are gone now. But yeah, I think if you could crew this multiple times, you could probably do some shenanigans with that.
Yeah, isn't there a dragon that lets you like pay 5 mana to just do an extra combat step and untap things?
Yeah, that's what, okay.
Wonky.
Right. So if you could like... Because especially with like multiple combats and being able to untap creatures.
Yeah, that gets real crazy real quick.
You'd be able to crew again. Yeah.
So gentle listener, if you caught the pun that Brian inadvertently made through the course of talking about the card, please let us know at judgecast@gmail.com. Thank you very much.
I made a funny that I don't even realize.
Yeah, it was pretty good too. I hope people get it. Marcus, on your listening and editing, take a look. You'll get it.
Can you post it in the chat? I'm really curious.
Yeah, I will in a minute.
Meta. Okay. What's
so
next?
So enough of all of that metamorphic thing. I don't know. I have no idea how to transition this card. Metamorphic Blast for 1 and a blue is an instant, and it's a spree card. So it has 2 options. For plus one, you can, until end of turn, target creature becomes a white rabbit with base power toughness 0/1. And for plus three, target player draws two cards. Hat count is at 34 now because there are two hats in the picture, even though one looks like some kind of weird alien version of a hat. The first ability causes the creature to lose its other colors and creature types, just setting them to white and rabbit. It doesn't lose any of its abilities. The effect of its first mode will overwrite any previous effects that set the creature's power and toughness to specific values. Remember the layers of power and toughness. Effects that otherwise modify the target creature's power and toughness will still apply no matter when they took effect. The same is true for plus one counters. Remember your timestamps, kids.
Seems fun. Seems fun. So I do have to say one thing about this set. I'm getting inspired to build decks and stuff because our next card that we're going to talk about, I really want to build a deck around. And I'm pretty sure it's like me and everybody else who wants to build a Grixis deck right now. But we have Obika, Splitter of Seconds. This is one, a blue, a black, and a red for a legendary creature, Ogre Warlock. It's a 2/5 with menace, and it says, whenever Obika, Splitter of Seconds deals combat damage to a player, you get that many additional upkeep steps after this phase. That's really cool. So let's talk about that. First of all, the all-important hat count is at 37.
Yeah, I think it's actually maybe a little higher. I'm trying to figure out how to interpret the one guy in the left who's split into like four different time streams. Who's wearing a hat. So I think we're going to bump it up to 40.
Hold on.
Well, he's four different realities. It's a real hat.
That is he's true. This isn't a different mirror. This is so actually
we're just going to bump it to 40. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's
fine. Why stop at
40? Why?
Just make it.
Why stop at 40? Why not let's subscribe to the multiverse theory and just go infinite right now?
Oh, wait. We'll get there.
Okay. All right.
All right. Well, let's talk about what happens when you get that many additional upkeep steps after this phase. So, since the upkeep step can only occur during the beginning phase, getting one or more upkeep steps outside of your normal beginning phase actually means that you get an additional beginning phase for each of those upkeeps after this phase. So in this instance, this creature has two power. Let's say you get through and hit a player. You're going to get two additional beginning phases for these two additional upkeep steps. However, in those beginning phases, don't get too excited, the untap and draw steps will be skipped. So, remember your steps and phases.
Are they skipped or you just don't get it?
I believe it states that they are skipped specifically because within the shell, if you're getting another beginning phase because you have to put an upkeep phase in there, I don't think you can have a beginning phase without those steps in it. But then you have to skip those because the only thing you're actually being granted by this card's ability is an upkeep step.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really weird ability. It's not something we've seen very often. Normally, we only talk about like additional combat phases, and like all of those steps are necessary to do a combat phase. But I don't know if this is the first time we've gotten an extra step, not just an extra phase before. I don't know. We'll have to look into that. But continuing on, the beginning phases that contain these additional upkeep steps occur after the current combat phase ends. So the last step of the combat phase is the end of combat step. So you'll go from your end of combat step right into your additional upkeep step or steps, depending on how many of them you got. Abilities that trigger at the beginning of your upkeep will trigger at the beginning of each additional upkeep as well. And I can already hear all of the keyboards frantically searching Scryfall for that one card that gives you cumulative upkeep, add red mana to your mana pool, get after it. After the beginning phases containing the additional upkeep steps, the game proceeds to the next phase as normal, which is most likely going to be your post-combat main phase, unless something has added even more steps, or sorry, even more phases. Which, speaking of, if multiple phases are added to the same point in your turn, the most recently created phase happens first. So this might seem a little unintuitive, so we're going to go into an example here. So let's say Okiba deals combat damage and its ability resolves during your combat damage step, giving you two additional upkeep steps with two beginning phases to boot on top of that. And at the end of combat, another effect gives you an additional combat phase after this combat phase. So now you have two things that are trying to give you extra phases after this combat phase. The additional combat phase will happen first because that's the most recent ability to resolve first, or the most recently created extra phase. So that one is going to happen first. You're going to go straight to that additional combat phase. And then you will follow with the additional beginning phases that you had received earlier. Really interesting card. Really fun mechanic, I think. This is the first time in a while that I've been like genuinely excited to build a commander deck around a mechanic.
Cool.
Yeah.
Next up is Oko the Ringleader, bringing our hat count to 41. For two green and a blue, we have a legendary planeswalker, Oko, three loyalties. And then says, at the beginning of combat on your turn, Oko the Ringleader becomes a copy of up to one target creature you control until end of turn, except he has hexproof. Then the plus one loyalty ability is draw two cards. If you've committed a crime this turn, discard a card. Otherwise, discard two cards. The minus one ability is create a 3/3 green elk creature token. And the minus five ability is for each other non-land permanent you control, create a token that's a copy of that permanent. All right. So we've talked a lot about copy stuff. So I'm just going to point out a few things here. At the beginning of combat, if you choose, you can choose not to have Oko become a copy of a creature, because it says it can become a copy of up to one target creature you control. So you just don't target anything. It doesn't become a copy. Okay. Not going to have hexproof if you don't make it a creature. If you do make it a creature, it is going to lose all of the planeswalker abilities until the end of turn. Now, it's not going to lose any planeswalker counters, but he's not going to have any loyalty abilities, and damage dealt to him is not going to cause him to lose loyalty counters. Losing those counters is something kind of inherent to the planeswalker type. So, anyway, yeah, that's the stuff. Just be a little forewarned. If you want to, say, commit a crime during combat in order to use the plus one, don't make Oko become a creature. Ba-dump-bump.
I just look forward to the next installment of Oko, Oko Dad Bod.
I mean, he is a dad. That is canon confirmed.
That would make Twitter very, very upset. All the thirsty folks on Twitter and happy. Very upset.
And happy. I think you'd be surprised. Anyway, we have the most ornery of critters, the ornery Tumblewag, next for two and a green. It is a 2/2. Creature bushwag mount. There are no hats in the picture, even though the saddle looks hat-like. It has,
fair,
at the fair, beginning of combat on your turn, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature. Whenever ornery Tumblewag attacks while saddled, double the number of +1/+1 counters on target creature. Saddle 2. So, doubling the number of +1/+1 counters means just that. If it has 10, add another 10. You add an equal number to whatever is already on the creature. Any cards that interact with putting counters on Ornery Bushwag or any other cards that care about counters in this set, because there are quite a number of them, will affect the counters accordingly.
That Brushwag looks like it's about to commit absolute carnage in that cacti field. I don't know which looks more dangerous, the Tumblewag or the cacti.
Yeah, I don't know.
I would argue that when a saddle is placed there, it kind of functions as a hat. Look, man, if we're doing like alternate reality hats or hats, that's a hat too.
Fair. Well,
I'm not convincing anyone.
No. It's okay. The hat count is about to go absolutely ridiculous. We have now up to 51, it looks like.
Yep.
Based off of our next card.
It's very hard to tell.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of hats.
There's a lot of hats in there. Let's look at Pitiless Carnage together. For 3 and a black, this is a sorcery that says sacrifice any number of permanents you control, then draw that many cards. And it has a plot cost of 1 black-black. So, sacrificing creatures is a part of the resolution of the spell, not the cost. If the spell is countered or otherwise leaves a stack before it finishes resolving, you don't sacrifice any creatures. You may choose to sacrifice no permanents. Hey, if you don't respect yourself, no one will. You can sacrifice nothing and draw nothing. That's fine, I guess. Do you, boo-boo? If anything triggers from creatures being sacrificed, those abilities wait their gosh darn turn and go on the stack after Pitiless Carnage finishes resolving. Get along, little doggies. How country are you making me? This is killing me.
The next card is Rakish Crew, which for 2 and a black brings the hat count up to 55. Rakish Crew is an enchantment that says when Rakish Crew enters the battlefield, create Star-Lord. Because it looks like a scene out of Guardians of the Galaxy. Nope.
It really does. It looks like Rocket on the right. It looks like Groot on the left. And the rest of them are all assembled. It's just the visual that I have looking at them.
Yep. So when Rakish Crew enters the battlefield, create a 1/1 red mercenary creature token with, quote, tap target creature you control gets +1/+0 until end of turn. Activate only as a sorcery, end quote. Okay. And then whenever an outlaw you control dies, of which you just made one, each opponent loses 1 life and you gain 1 life. The last trigger, so what we want to talk about here, if 1 or more outlaws die at the same time, Rakish Crew leaves the battlefield. So let's say here, board wipe. Its last ability is still going to trigger for each outlaw leaving the battlefield. Now, it's not actually leaving the battlefield, it's when it dies. Okay, so like a farewell is, you know, sad face, but something like pity, you know, if you pitilessly carnage a bunch of outlaws, the opponents are going to lose 1 life and gain 1 life, or opponents are going to lose 1 life and you're going to gain 1 life for each one of those outlaws that died. That actually didn't prove the example at all, because it didn't also destroy enchantments.
What's one that does everything? But, there was the one Dune Blast or something like that.
No, that's all creatures. And destroy all non-white permanents, something like that. Go.
I'm so thankful for the many different options and paths that you all have provided for us. And so is Riku, who is also of many paths. For green, a blue, and a red. He's a 3/3 legendary creature, human wizard. Brings our hat count to 56, which is just so exciting. And he has really weird text, and it goes something like this. Whenever you cast a modal spell, choose up to X, where X is the number of times you chose a mode for that spell. And then you can do one of the three different modes that are listed for the trigger, which is exile the top card of your library until the end of your next turn. You may play it, or put a +1/+1 counter on Riku of many paths. It gains trample until end of turn, or create a 1/1 bluebird creature token with flying. Spells are modal if they have 2 or more options in a bulleted list. This now includes spree spells. Those are modal. You will often see it expressed as choose one or choose one or more, or however it is. It's often choose followed by some descriptor telling you how many to pick. Modal spells printed before cons. And hold on to your hats. That was 10 years ago. I feel old. So they did not use bulleted lists on modal spells. So printed cards from the Dark Ages will look a little different. No bullets. The X in Riku's ability is referencing the number of times you chose a mode for the modal spell cast. not the separate modes you chose. So if it has three modes and you chose two of the modes and they just were cast that way, you only get X is equal to one because each one was only cast one time and you're not counting that. What you really want to count is you want to count how many times, if you can, you cast a modal spell with a mode multiple times. So if you cast a line from a modal spell three times, X would be equal to three, which is kind of the magic number here. You can't choose a mode of Riku's ability more than once for each event it triggers, and paying all costs and timing restrictions apply to cards played from Riku's first mode, which is the exile part.
Okay, two notes on Riku. One, he looks a little like a Western Harry Dresden, and that's kind of awesome. And secondly, this is a big deviation from the first Riku card that I remember, but I guess this isn't his first rodeo, so, you know. Anyway,
I would like to point something out.
Yeah,
Harry Dresden does not wear hats. Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, that's true. Sorry, he looks like the cover art for Harry Dresden in all his books, despite the fact that he never actually is wearing a cowboy hat. You are correct. You got me. This is not your first rodeo either.
No, I'm gonna out pedant you.
When it comes to Harry all Dresden, right. I believe that.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. I'm getting there, but yeah, you got me. So we have Rodeo Pyromancers for three and a red. It is a 3/4 creature human mercenary. Whenever you cast your first spell each turn, add red, red. So this triggered ability is not a mana ability. It uses the stack and it can be responded to. In order for a triggered ability to be a mana ability, it has to trigger off of tapping for mana. That ability triggers only while Rodeo Pyromancers is on the battlefield. So notably, it's not going to trigger on a turn that you cast Rodeo Pyromancers, no matter which spell it was, because you can't get past the first spell. You're already way past it if you had to cast Rodeo Pyromancers. So that is all. Oh, I'm all sorry. Right. Not all. Now the hat count is at 58.
Yep.
Almost past that really important part.
The next card is Satori the Infiltrator.
Satoru?
Brings our hat count. Satoru. Yeah, and actually, I believe we might have had double wrong because there are two extra hats in this art. There are a total of three hats in this artwork, I believe. At least two.
Mm. Are there really?
And in the foreground, there's the guy, and then in the background, there's someone's hats flying off their head.
Uh-huh. That's the second one.
So all of our hat counts are off by one.
No.
That's
okay. It's fixed.
Anyway, so hack, is it up to 61 now?
61 now.
It is.
Okay, hat count 61. Editor.
Thank you.
The most important part, the only thing that's keeping me engaged in this is hat count. For a blue and a black, Satoru the Infiltrator is a 2/3 legendary creature human ninja rogue with menace that says whenever Satoru the Infiltrator and or one or more other non-token creatures enter the battlefield under your control, if none of them were cast or no mana was spent to cast them, draw a card. Which this card, while it brings our hat count up to 61, it brings our intervening if clause trigger counts to 3.
The count is at 3.
The count is at 3. All right. So if you cast a creature spell without paying the mana cost, but you paid mana for additional costs or cost increases, like Aven Interrupter, if you plot something and you're casting it from exile, Aven Interrupter makes you pay a little bit more. Satoru's last ability doesn't trigger. Why? Intervening if clauses. Yes. It doesn't care what the mana was spent for. If it's spent on that creature, it's not gonna work. So this card does just, it's got like all the and ors, one or mores, and if no, you know, if none of them were cast or no mana was spent to cast them, draw a card. Ugh, blah, blah. It doesn't parse well.
I just want to know how a ninja got on the plane, that's all.
Those omen paths, man.
Yeah, they were real trailblazers, right?
They are.
So Savala is also here, and she's an eager trailblazer. 2, a green and a white is a casting cost for a 4/5 legendary creature elf scout. They have vigilance. Whenever you cast a creature spell, create a 1/1 red mercenary creature token with tap. Target creature you control gets +1/+0 until end of turn. Activate only as a sorcery. Have I gotten every ability that grants the +1/+1 red mercenary creatures?
No, I've had two of them.
You've had? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think I've had one.
Okay. And it also has tap, choose a color, add 1 mana of that color for each different power among creatures you control. And that's really the thing that we want to talk about here, because we haven't, there are one or two opportunities earlier, but we don't pick every card. But this last ability is a mana ability. That means that it doesn't use the stack. Players can't respond to it. It also looks at the creatures you control as it resolves. So if you control Savala at the time, which she's a base 4/5, if you control a 2/2 bear cub, a 2/2 goblin, and a 1/2 fairy, you get 3 mana of the chosen color, because just because you control 4 colors, 2 of those creatures had the same power. It also, with the last ability, does not care what the colors are of the creatures that are on the board. They could all be red, your deck could be all red, and you can create blue mana, whatever you want to do. It's your life, you live it the best way you can. That's that.
Oh, I'm so glad I get to do this card. So, the hat count is now up to 64 with our next card, Shoot the Sheriff. For 1 and a black, it's an instant. Destroy target non-outlaw creature. Reminder, assassins, mercenaries, pirates, and rogues, and warlocks are outlaws. Everyone else is fair game. That is literally the reminder text, and I love it. So, really important fact here. The only deputy in the set has the subtype of mercenary. So unless you remove it through some form of deep magics of some sort, you cannot, in fact, shoot the deputy.
I shot the sheriff, but I did not shoot the deputy.
No notes. Perfect card.
The next card is Step Between Worlds. For 3 blue-blue, it is a sorcery that says each player may shuffle their hand and graveyard into their library. Each player who does draws 7 cards. Exile Step Between Worlds. And then it has plot, 4 blue-blue. Now you're going to ask yourself, it's like it says each player may shuffle their library into their hand, and then each player who does draw 7 cards, do I get to know? Like, because we're going to play this in a Commander game. Obviously, it's going to be played in Commander. Or if people play it, it's going to be in there. Do I know if people are going to shuffle their hands in the library before I decide? Right? So, how does this spell actually work? In turn order, Apnap, so active player goes first. They're going to choose whether or not they will shuffle their hand and graveyard into the library. So you get to know the decision that everyone before you has made. Then, once all that decisions has been made, everyone is going to shuffle their graveyard into their hand and then draw the 7 cards. Players, after the active player and earlier than the non-active player, in this case in the multiplayer games, get to see what's happening and make choices based on the other choices. A player with no hand and or no graveyard can still choose to shuffle what they have into the library, or just shuffle, and then they're going to draw 7 cards. So, yay?
Yeah, it's they just shuffle. Let me be clear about it, because I'm the one that wrote this. Or just shuffle if they have nothing to put into the graveyard. They can still choose to do that, and then they'll draw 7 cards. So I think this is the kind of card that blue player would want to play when they have nothing left in their tank, and maybe other players still have hands, and they can kind of force them to make that choice as to whether or not they're going to continue with the hand that they have, or pitch it away and hope to get something better. And the blue player is just snickering on the side and saying, ha ha ha, I got them now.
Yep. And in case I didn't say it before, the hat count is 67.
Nice. Oh, yeah, the 2 in the background. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I missed those the first time. I'm sorry. I'm working on it. We're getting better.
No, that's good.
You're doing good. This is what happens when you hire the lowest bid. You get contractors that just don't do the work well. Mm. They're kind of unscrupulous. Anyway, the unscrupulous contractor for 2 and a black. is a 3/2 creature human assassin. And when unscrupulous contractor enters the battlefield, you may sacrifice a creature. When you do, target player draws 2 cards and you lose 2 life. And you can plot it for 2 and a black. Hat count is now at 69. There's a hat on the ground next to the feller leaning up against the balcony railing there. Yeah. Reflexive trigger time. We haven't had one of these yet as far as I know tonight. You don't choose a target player when this trigger goes on the stack. A second, that's the reflexive part. Trigger will go on the stack when you sack a creature to the first part. If that happens, you choose a target for the ability. Players may then respond to this ability as normal. The initial trigger is not a crime. However, the reflexive trigger might be. So keep that in mind as you play this card.
Might be because it says target player.
Right.
Okay. It's not like, it might be, might not, we don't know.
No, it could be you.
Yeah.
You could target yourself. And oftentimes that's the kind of thing that you want to do with a card like this. But you could let your opponent draw 2 cards.
Flexibility. I like it.
Yep.
You know, it's really flexible.
Uh-oh.
The snakes on Vraska's head.
Not quite where I thought you were
going.
I'm
glad he went there.
So we have Vraska the Silencer, a legendary creature, Gorgon Assassin, for 1, a black and a green. She is a 3/3, and she is also unphyrexianized. She has Death Touch, and whenever a non-token creature an opponent controls dies, you may pay 1 generic mana. If you do, return that card to the battlefield tapped under your control. It's a treasure artifact with, and this is all in quotes, tap, sacrifice this artifact, add 1 mana of any color, and it loses all other card types. So here, the card returned by Vraska's trigger will lose any other subtypes and card types and will only be a treasure artifact. Interestingly enough, it will retain its super types as well as its abilities. So that's cool.
So depending on how you count things, and I count things weirder than others, the hat count is right now at 70, correct?
Yeah.
One in the stone behind Vraska?
There are 48 more hats that we missed.
What?
We're actually at 8, carry the 1, 118 hats.
What?
The set symbol. Everybody. Y'all missed it.
You know, I was going to say something about that. And then...
Wait, what was the total? 118.
Yep.
Okay, so that means that we did 48 cards?
We did 48 cards.
And there was more than 1 hat per card on average?
Oh, yeah. Almost 2.
All right.
That's a lot of hats.
Okay, so let's do big score real quick.
Sure.
Because these are cards that you can get in packs. There are 4 of them.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because these are cards that you can get out of packs. So
yeah, and they're new designs, so we should talk about them. All the other random stuff are usually going to be reprints, so hopefully you don't need to go over those. And if you do, we have older episodes that cover that. So anyways, let's go to Collector's Cage. Collector's Cage is 1 and a white. This is an artifact with Hideaway 5. Reminder text for that. When this artifact enters the battlefield, look at the top 5 cards of your library. Exile 1 face down. Then put the rest on the bottom in a random order. And it has the ability, generic mana, so 1 generic mana, tap, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. Then, if you control 3 or more creatures with different powers, you may play the exiled card without paying its mana cost. So, any player who has controlled a permanent with Hideaway can look at the card exiled with it, even if they no longer control that Hideaway permanent. So, somebody demolishes your Collector's Cage, you can still look at the card that was exiled with it. You have the right to that information.
So, this is more like if the Collector's Cage just like bounces around from player to player to player with control effects. Once you're able to look at it with the Hideaway, you're forever able to look at it.
Yep. Good call.
Even if you don't control it anymore. Okay.
There you go. Hideaway cards used to include enters the battlefield tapped as part of the Hideaway ability. This has been broken out from the ability itself. This card does not enter the battlefield tapped. And Collector's Cage, the ability looks at the creatures you control as it resolves. to check to see if you can play the exiled card. Pretty neat little card.
All right. The next card is this card that is called Esoteric Duplicator, and I wanted to talk about it because this has generated a fair amount of questions online. Have you guys seen
oh,
the questions
goodness,
involving
yeah.
this?
As soon as All I right. see KCI, I just groan.
Yeah. So this card, Esoteric Duplicator, is an artifact clue for 2 and a blue. That says whenever you sacrifice Esoteric Duplicator or another artifact, you may pay 2. If you do, okay, so this is not a reflexive trigger. It says if you do, at the beginning, well, it's part of a clause that sets up a delayed trigger instead of a reflexive trigger. So if you do, at the beginning of the next end step, create a token that's a copy of that artifact. And then 2, sacrifice Esoteric Duplicator, draw a card. So the first thing that I'm going to point out that I've seen is people asking, well, this is a clue. Actually, I have not seen people ask that, so I'm not going to go into that. but what I have seen is the Ugin's Nexus. This is a card that says if a player would begin an extra turn, that player skips this turn instead. And then it says, if Ugin's Nexus would be put into a graveyard from the battlefield, instead exile it and take an extra turn after this one. So the question is, if I am somehow able to sacrifice Ugin's Nexus, I have an Esoteric Duplicator, an Ugin's Nexus, and then maybe something like a Crack Clan Ironworks that lets me sacrifice an artifact to add 2 to my mana pool, does that mean infinite turns? And the answer is, yes, but only if you're real picky about the timing, okay? Because what happens is, it says whenever you sacrifice Esoteric Duplicator or another artifact, you may pay 2. So we'll say, let's sacrifice Ugin's Nexus to Crack Clan Ironworks. And it says, if Ugin's Nexus would be put into the graveyard from the battlefield, instead exile it and take an extra turn after this one. Cool. So I've sacrificed it. I'm going to get another turn after this one. And then I have the 2 mana. So Esoteric Duplicator says whenever you sacrifice Esoteric Duplicator or another artifact, which you did, you may pay 2, which you have. If you do, at the beginning of the next end step, create a token that's a copy of that artifact. So at the beginning of the next end step, which if you do this on your turn, okay, at the beginning of the next end step, you are going to create a token that is a copy of Ugin's Nexus. Now, if that's where you stop, when you go to take your extra turn from Ugin's Nexus, so from sacrificing it, Ugin's Nexus says if a player would begin an extra turn, that player skips that turn instead. So you gotta get rid of Crack Clan. You gotta get rid of that copy of Ugin's Nexus. Well, it just so happens that you got a Crack Clan Ironworks right there. So just in your end step, before you start your next turn, sack Ugin's Nexus. Again, the token to Crack Clan Ironworks. Then you will start your extra turn, and then at the beginning of the end step on that extra turn, you are going to make a copy of Ugin's Nexus, and then sack it. And you get to take all the turns, and everyone hates you. The end.
I'm glad you ended on those words, because that is exactly what went through my mind as you were describing this.
Yep. I've just been informed that it's Esoteric and not Esoteric, and it's Quark Clan Ironworks instead of crack or whatever word I said. I'm just making up things now. I'm just going to grunt some syllables
just call
at
it KCI.
You. Just ugh, duplicator.
Yeah, we all call it KCI anyway.
Yeah, it's Crack Clan, it's Kark Clan, it's Cartouche Clan.
Yeah, don't
whatever.
Disrespect my goblins. Although I hate the card as much as everybody else does that you judge.
Well, then so. What are you getting on me for painting on them
saying.
Then?
I'm just saying.
Count your hats.
Yeah. I'm going to go loot something.
All right. Okay.
Okay. So I get to tell you all about this cute little Pokemon. Loot the Key to Everything for 1 green, 1 blue, 1 red. It's a 1/2 legendary creature beast noble. Now, how does this thing get noble when Goblin King? Never mind. You all know me.
That
the text
is
on it
the real mystery of the vault.
I know, right? The text on it is Ward 1, And at the beginning of your upkeep, exile the top X cards of your library, where X is the number of card types among other non-land permanents you control. You may play those cards this turn. So if the only artifact you have is an artifact land, it won't count it because the card isn't non-land. That's the only important note here for it looks like a freaky cross between a goblin or a gremlin and a gremlin and a Pokemon, and I'm just unsettled by it every time I look at its picture. But I know that some people like it and think it's cute and the eyes are adorable, so hey, you know, loot is cool.
You know what I don't like about this particular art that we have featured is I think it's like the little green sashes or whatever that's spilling over the edge of the vault are exactly where you would expect feet to be.
Yeah.
And so it looks like it has these weird little green sock feet, and it doesn't.
So this was apparently like the big thing that's like hidden in this vault that the gang on this plane and then the story was trying to crack into to capture.
So this
is a noble. So
we'll see.
I'm feeling inspired.
It's going to go into whatever, Bloomborough or whatever. It's just...
But also, I'm now inspired to do a heist. And you've inspired me on this one, Charles. We need to plan our own Oko Ringleader or Ocean's 11 style heist to get into Wizards headquarters. Sneak in there and get into their database. Get into Drake and... put noble on Goblin King, please and thank you. Yeah. We won't do anything else. We won't look at any other cards.
We promise
we
not
won't
to.
Spoil. We really no, won't. No, no shenanigans. No.
It'll be a Mission Impossible level action. We'll get the knock list and no harm, no foul.
Yeah, and then we'll just walk away. We'll even leave him a pizza as a thank you. It'll
yeah,
be fine.
Yeah,
so. And the last card that we're going to talk about, we're at the end. Let's get it. Sword of Wealth and Power. This is a 3-mana artifact, 3 generic mana for an artifact equipment. Equipped creature gets +2/+2 and has protection from instants and from sorceries. Whenever equipped creature deals combat damage to a player, create a treasure token. When you next cast an instant or sorcery spell this turn, copy that spell. You may choose new targets for the copy. And it has equipped too. So another cycle for the Sword of Blank and Blank cycle that we thought was complete, but here's a special 11th version. Now for this, protection from instants and sorceries does mean that you can still be destroyed by a Wrath of God. So remember the acronym of DET. So it can't be dealt damage, it can't be equipped or enchanted by. It can't be blocked by, and it can't be targeted by anything with that quality. And, of course, the standard copying disclaimer stuff. X is 0. You can pay additional costs. All that stuff that we've been talking about the whole episode still applies here for when you're copying that spell. Note that it's saying copy that spell, not cast that copy. So it's not being cast. You know what this is. We're done.
Yeah, we're done.
We're done. We're done. We're done. How do we all feel?
Tired.
Did we find some joy in there? I think we actually started laughing again at some point. We might have found something fun in there after all.
Look, are you like doing like some sort of like, Brian, did you learn your lesson?
I'm feeling a little like Scrubs wrap up thing. Like in the end.
Oh, idiot.
At the end of the day, Brian knew that the joy really came from inside his heart all along.
Hanging out with people I enjoy.
That's what was inside the vault. It was Brian's joy.
Brian's joy.
Okay, what are you doing all this live, laugh, love stuff?
Nah, set seems cool. Set seems very powerful. Set seems very copy heavy and very just, yeah.
It almost seems like a sub-theme in some ways. Just a minor one, a baby one, but it's got more copy than I've seen in anything outside of like a master set, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But I'm intrigued to play it. It looks fun at the very least.
I think they got drunk making this. They just like sat back and started drinking and started like, right. It's very clear that they had a lot of fun making this set.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's very clear that they did that. I think they needed to take about 10% off the top.
Take up a 10% off their squirrely Dan.
Yeah, yeah. I think they just squirrely dandling it.
Well, I mean, by this point, other people have seen all the cards in the set. There's obviously even more inside jokes and jokes about pop culture media that made its way into the set that we haven't talked about. I mean, literally, there's Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote on two different cards. There's Holy Cow with a reference in the flavor text to When Pigs Fly. There's
bovine intervention.
Do you remember?
There's a lot of great, great asides, and it's funny. It's funny. It's cute. It just seems like it's. There have been a lot of people that said it's an unset, and I will not agree that it's an unset. But I think people who name cards, the people who write flavor text, and the people who do art were either encouraged or given wild freedoms that they have not had in the past, I think, because there are a lot of humor. There's a lot of humor built into the set that we don't normally see in an average set, which is interesting.
You know what this set feels like? And I realized this while I was walking my dog earlier tonight. Do you remember the movie? I think it was Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
Okay, with like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger
as Mr. Freeze, and yeah.
Right, and yeah. Like Val Kilmer's Batman having the credit card with the bat, you know, with the Batman logo on it. And it was just kind of over the top goofy, and they had some jokes that if it wasn't already saturated with a lot of jokes like that, like I think there was a scene where Robin's climbing up a hill and he's like, "Holy rusted metal, Batman." And Batman's like, "What?" And he's like, "There's metal that's rusty that has holes in it." You know, like, and
that was
particular
actually Batman Forever, but I'll let it slide.
Sure. But you just kind of like, you're like, I don't know. It's like jokes like that need to be kind of sparse. And I feel like they just kind of dialed the kitsch up a little too high with this set.
Like, they winked one too many times at the audience, like...
Yeah.
We're like, okay, get back to the performance and stop winking at us. We get it.
Right. That's kind of my vibe. And I told you guys beforehand, like, I'm stage manager for Command Fest Dallas, okay? I was really excited about this. I've been making, like, cowboy jokes about what we were going to do. The TO gave me a hat budget. Okay, to get cowboy hats. And just, like, this set with its varmints and its tarnations and its excessive hats and stuff like that, I kind of feel like I can't do the hat jokes because the set already played it out. Like, it just, like, the jokes that I could make feel played out. So, probably not going to be getting hats.
I think, and I could be really off the mark here, but I think what's happening is the universe's beyond thought process that's gone into designing sets. They have all of their creative teams that probably touch into those different products at different times. And I think that is bleeding over a little bit into the set. I'm curious as to what will happen with the next one. I would imagine that there will be references to Watership Down and to Redwall.
You know, interesting. Maybe secret of Nim, yeah. You know, okay, sure, yeah. Maybe, but like, I just hope it's not just constant, you know, ease up a bit.
Well, we'll get back to Sirius soon, I'm sure. I mean, the set is complicated too. It's got a lot of mechanic stuff happening that we haven't seen in a little while. We keep saying that the sets keep getting more complicated, but I think this one's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
Spree is going to be a neat mechanic. Anyway, any other thoughts?
No.
I'm thoughted out.
Wonderful. So that's our episode. Join us next time when we share some stories from Star City Games. Is it Star City Games Con? Is it SCG Con Atlanta? I think
SCG
so.
SCG Con.
Yes.
And wait. You all may not know this, but Brian, Marcus, and I will all be there. That's right. We're all going to be at SCG Con Atlanta. We will be talking to judges and staff and having a grand old time. But if you're a player or if you're a guest and you want to come up and say hi to one of us, we're happy to talk to you. If you have feedback about the show, we're also very happy to receive it. So we'll see you all in Atlanta. Until we get to the next show, you can send us an email at judgecast@gmail.com or like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at JudgeCast and on Blue Sky at judgecast.bsky.social and check out any of our social media for invite links to our Discord server for judges new and old, fans, and anyone who supports the judging community. I'm Charles Featherer, and I keep it fair.
I'm Marcos Sanchez, and I keep it fun.
I'm Brian Perlman, and I simultaneously am all hat and all cattle.